Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from western Idaho, where the wind is blowing about 200 miles an hour, and it's chilling down quick. We're probably going to have a blizzard tonight, while the rest of you enjoy pretty fair weather around the country. We're glad you're here with us. We couldn't be here without you. The solar wind tonight is 437 kilometers per second. With no sunspots to break the monotony, the face of the sun has been blank and quiet for nearly a month. The edge of the sun is another matter. The solar limb has been pretty busy lately. Anybody see the movie Knowing lately? Alaska's Mount Redoubt volcano has erupted no fewer than 19 times since March 22nd, 7 days ago. And several of the larger blasts have hurled plumes of ash and gas into the lower stratosphere. The GOMI-2, which is the Global Ozone Monitoring Experiment, that's aboard Europe's MetOp-A satellite, has been tracking Redoubt's sulfur dioxide emissions. By the way, emissions like this are responsible for global cooling, as the particulate matter blocks the light of the sun. Are you ready for a global currency that might not be the dollar? Well, China this week announced that it might be considering replacing the American dollar with a more stable currency because of behaviors by America that are weakening the dollar. Yesterday, during a Financial Services Committee hearing, Secretary Geithner was asked if he would denounce efforts to move toward a global currency, and he answered unequivocally that he would. President Obama gave the nation the same assurances, but just a day later, Secretary Geithner has left the option on the table. Interviewers wanted to know which is which. The American people deserve to know. It seems that there might be efforts to go the next step in one world governing sooner rather than later. Don't think that hoarding cash will help either. You'll likely have a short holiday to turn it all in before they lower the boom on dollars. Stay tuned for more. A UN panel of expert economists pressed Thursday for a new global currency reserve scheme to replace the volatile dollar-based system and for coordinated steps with rich countries to stimulate their economies. A new global reserve system is what they say. What may be viewed as a greatly expanded SDR, special drawing rights, with regular or cyclical adjusted emissions calibrated to the size of reserve accumulations. It's fancy for having enough money in the bank to pay the bills, could contribute to global stability, economic strength, and global equity, the panel said. Global equity. That's got an interesting ring to it. Stiglitz said that his panel experts were currently trying to lay out the conceptual framework of how this might be done. Interesting news, and we'll keep you completely abreast of that as we watch the Earth changes and economic changes unfold here on X Squared Radio. We're glad you tuned in and are getting squared. We also want you to keep in mind that our affiliates, Campus Book Rentals, wow, are they doing well. Interesting idea for those of you that have kids in college. I have two. And it can get quite expensive a couple times a year when you sit down to buy all of those short-run textbooks at about $150 a copy. But if you go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Campus Book Rentals banner, guess what you can do? You could rent textbooks for a semester. At the end of the semester, you can turn them back in, just like you do those little red box movies down at Walmart. What a great idea. And also, back by popular demand, NitroPack, the emergency preparedness specialists. If you're trying to get your getaway kit together or just put back some really portable food storage that you can use in case of a disaster, please visit NitroPack. They're the best in the business. 20 years they've been at it, and we're glad they're back as an affiliate. And also, if you have an inkjet printer, I have a couple sitting right next to me here, which hungrily consume inkjet cartridges, which if you buy them from a national chain store, you will pay dearly for. But if you get them from 123 Inkjets, not only do you get incredible prices and free shipping, you also get a chance to win a free printer every single time you buy. Now, how cool is that? Come on. And also, Academic Superstore. Now, those of you that are students or like to buy expensive brand-name software like Adobe, Microsoft, or other brands, you can't beat Academic Superstore's prices. 80% off and free shipping. Come on. Don't pass that up. Last week, we had an excellent, excellent interview. Just fantastic interview. Please, you need to go back and listen to that interview if you missed it. It's on the archives. It doesn't cost much to subscribe. Less than $2.50 a month. $20 a year, less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. And you get over 200 hours of spine-tingling, edge-of-technology interviews with the best in the business. Tonight, our distinguished guest, I just finished reading his book. In fact, I couldn't put it down. Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. I read it twice. Post-it notes sticking out all through it. Dr. John L. Turner liked to go by Jack. It's a doctor's journey through the worlds of divine intervention, near-death experiences, and universal energy. Welcome to the program. Jack, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Brooks, and thank you for having me on. I really appreciate a chance to talk with someone of your caliber and interest.
Oh, the feeling is mutual, I can assure you. You know, Jack and I have traded excited emails back and forth for a couple of, probably better, close to a month. His publicist sent me the book, which I eagerly snatched it up and read, and then read it again so that I could get ready for the program tonight. It seems as though there's a synergistic pathway of discovery here, and we're going to open it up like a can of tuna tonight and really talk about it. In your book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, it is a wonderful journey. I highly recommend the book, and you can get it by clicking on his link there at X Squared Radio in the archives or under the guests page. And pick up the book, and he'll probably send it to you autographed if you buy it from his website. You open the book by recalling that you were working a computerized version of the I Ching, and you asked a question about the optimum trajectory of your life. What prompted you to ask about the path in your life?
Dr. Agnew, may I call you Brooks?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Okay. Brooks, I had been interested in things like the Celtic runes, and I met a lot of people who, experimented with Rife machines, and there were New Age thinkers, and when this came out, it was something like the runes, but I could do it on the computer, and that day you're mentioning in 1995, I had just installed it on a computer, and I said, well, let me give it a try and see what happens. So the question I put to that computerized version of the I Ching was, am I on the right track? I guess I wanted an idea as to where I stood in life and how things were going. And the response was very interesting. It was something that made me decide I should start writing down these experiences then. It said that there was enormous potential around the corner, basically, and if one's actions were in alignment with, well, it said the general good, the creativity will be rewarded with immense success. Well, that was all well and good, but the key thing was it said, but be forewarned, success can turn to failure if strength turns to arrogance. So hopefully this guided me in the right path, not to develop any type of arrogance, but just to tell the story. And I'm glad you enjoyed reading the book, Brooks.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, we get a lot of books in here. We read over 60 books a year for this program. And a lot of them are astronomy, astrophysics, mathematics, and some of them get a little deep and more factual than story-like. Yours is sort of like a biography, and your experiences in the operating room and the patients with whom you interacted. And it's not only fascinating and entertaining, but I found myself laughing. I found myself on the edge of tears. A great emotional touch with this book, and I really applaud you for your writing style. Very, very good stuff.
Oh, thank you. That's kind of you to say those things, Brooks.
You know, we modern people sometimes think that the ancients were also primitive. What prompted you to consult with these ancient sources for guidance?
Well, I found these things to be very interesting. As I started out talking about the Celtic runes, when I first saw those, I said, my gosh, this is strange how this works. It's kind of interesting. And I remember one friend from Africa was visiting me in Hilo, and I told him, I said, look at this. Try this. Pull three of these stones out of this bag and let me read from you from this guidebook what it says. So he did, and I read to him, and then he suddenly got the chills. And I said, what's wrong? He said, please put those away. And I said, well, what's the problem, Dan? He said, I tell you, when I was a boy, we had a medicine man we met on the road. We were just walking, and he said, come here, boys, I want to show you something. And he showed me his arm where he had a cut. And Dan continued to say, he told us that whenever he had to make a decision, if the answer was no, this cut would start throbbing. He'd rub some type of herbs in there. And he said, well, I want to try it for you guys, and you'll see that if the answer is no, it'll throb in a different way from yes. So he made a cut on my friend's arm, and he said ever since childhood, he would consult his cut to see what to make the right decision, and eventually made him kind of crazy. So he said, please put those runes away.
My
well,
gosh.
I did, but it didn't bother me. I kind of liked the idea, and then the I Ching, when that came out, rather than, you know, throwing sticks out of a container, it's much easier to sit down at a computer and get a similar answer. So I had always had an interest in these things, Brooks, and this day I decided to throw the stone, so to speak, and see what came up, and that was the answer.
Interesting. Very interesting stuff. So how do you distinguish between genuine value in metaphysical sources and the sort of mystical doublespeak we so often hear?
The Buddhists have always said, especially the Zen Buddhists, perhaps, that, you know, never really believe anything unless you've seen it for yourself. And that's kind of good advice. And in my case, I decided I wanted to see these things for myself. I wanted to try to answer the question of life, death, and life after death. And I was in a position as the only neurosurgeon on this island to become quite involved with the patients and their families. So it did open up new doors for me. At times I had planned to leave Hawaii, but it never worked out. Hawaii still needed me, I guess, because here I am. But I had planned to go to Africa at one time to be of more help. In Ghana, there were 20 million people with only two neurosurgeons. And also, some mystical things were happening. I was about to go to a ceremony in Benin and Senegal that only men can go through. That once that's completed, I was told these other doors to other dimensions will open up. And that certainly sounds exciting, but yet here I am, and the doors are opening up right here. So I think it doesn't make any difference where we are. When we're open to it, it will happen. And as you said, many are called, but few choose. So this was my choice to try to undergo these things.
Well, that's cool. It's quite inspirational to watch I won't say the transformation. I mean, I like the way that you gave the tools that you were presented to a serious effort with a significant period of time. I mean, you didn't try them for a weekend or a conference. You gave at least by my recollection in the book, about a year for several specific disciplines, and you practiced what they asked you to practice and the way they asked you to practice it, and you gave it, you know, full duty and discipline. And what I want to know is, how did you decide which school you would attend and with which teachers? Because there's more than you can do in a single lifetime out there.
Well, Brooks, you remember the chapter in my book called The Tree of Life, where on the beach, on Honolulu Beach, I asked my friend, I had asked him about astral projection, and he decided that he would explain briefly to me that that's not the type of thing you do for the sake of doing it. And then he said, once you become enlightened, this and many other things will start to happen. Well, it's very interesting what happened from that day on. I said, well, I'm going to try that, because I knew this guy was very smart. He's a neurosurgeon, but he's one of the smart ones, much smarter than me. And I knew that he was telling me the truth, because he was a friend and very well educated. So the teachers that came along the path, you know the saying, when a teacher is needed, they will appear, he or she will appear, and that's what happened. And this man, my friend Tyrone, was one of those teachers. And that experience led me just to follow along, seeking this spiritual path until the end of the book, when I realized what that path actually is. But that's basically how I came across teachers and events. I just kind of let them unfold, and I tried them in year stretches because I wanted to devote myself to really getting into it and finding out, well, how does it actually work? I hope that answers your question in that regard.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I had great respect for Tyrone's sort of binary way of stepping forward along the Tree of Life. He sort of looked left and saw storm clouds, and you looked right and saw sunshine and clear ocean, and, you know, he said, this is what it's like. You get to these choices and you look both ways, and, you know, the one that gives you the feeling is the way you step, is basically the way he described it. But the one, I won't call it an issue I had with it, but, you know, you had a desire to astrally travel, to have an out-of-body experience that you could control and move with, and his response is, well, you don't just do it just to do it. But, you know, I grew up loving to fly. I mean, I flew in my dreams. And as a young boy, I started taking private flying lessons. And I have more time behind the controls of a single-engine aircraft than some pilots do. And I tried getting my license several times, and I just I lost interest in it, because getting from point A to point B flying wasn't what I was after. I was just after getting in the air. So I became fascinated with ultralight flying, because I got the more lawn chair in the sky feeling, you know, with the wind in your face a few hundred feet off the trees, which you certainly can't do in a Cessna. So I did it just to do it, not to actually have purpose. Did you feel like that was a little bit of a disappointment to you, that I really want to learn to astrally travel and I don't really want to have a purpose to it yet?
Well, I can't remember what show I mentioned. There was a radio interview in which I said that I'd been married more than once, and I got in touch with my first wife at some point, and just to say hello after many, many years, and her first comment was, hi, are you still laying down there on the couch trying to roll out of your body? And she knew me back from undergraduate school and graduate school days. I said, you're kidding. Was I really interested in that so long ago? And she said, that's all you ever wanted to do. It's all you ever talked about. So it's true what you say, Brooks. I wanted to experience that. I wanted to have the feeling, but I wasn't getting any place. And about 10 years ago, I met gentleman you're probably familiar with, Robert Bruce, who wrote his first book, Astrodynamics, which was a great book on all the mechanics of astral projection and ways to do it and so forth. Kind of like the projection of astral body by Muldoon and Carrington way back when I started reading these things. But all these years, Brooks, I didn't get any place. And the year I spent with Ekinkar, they sent monthly lessons for 12 months of different techniques to roll out of the body, and I tried all these, but to no avail. And only when Tyrone said, once you become enlightened, this and many other things will start to happen, did I give up that idea, although I kept in great touch with Robert Bruce, and I appreciated all his writing and all his help. But I told him along the way, I said, Robert, I'm going to try this other way, and I don't know if I'll ever make it to any type of enlightenment, but I'm willing to give it a try. So that's why I kind of gave up the idea, Brooks, of experimenting and trying to force it. And I said, let me try the other way and see if Tyrone is right.
So did you discover that enlightenment and astral travel was sort of a chicken and egg relationship?
You know, it's interesting about that because I can't say I'm near any real enlightenment, but when I returned from London, and I don't know if you know the story of my friend and webmaster Martin Simmons, who passed away on February 7th of this year. But I was there for the entire process of his death, and to be there for that long and to be there during that exact moment that that last breath is taken changed something with me. When I got back, I had two dreams concerning this, and it also concerned something very strange, a strange type of a void or blackness that I had never seen before, never dreamt about before. But after a coast-to-coast appearance with George Noory, I received a tremendous amount of email, and a couple of them had to do with that blackness, people who had experienced that during their out-of-the-body experiences, and they wanted to know a little bit more about that experience I had that was a spontaneous out-of-the-body experience, the first time it ever happened to me. But it only happened after reaching a certain level of understanding that happened regarding the death of my friend. So none of this is in that book. The book finished before I started on this interest in the afterlife. But I think there's something with the spirituality, something with that blackness or void, almost like a portal to other dimensions, because I've had two experiences with it in the last month.
Most interesting. I highly recommend Dr. Gary Schwartz. He wrote a book called The Afterlife Experiments. And he also wrote a book called The God Experiments. And he is a sociologist, psychiatrist, and also an advisor for surgery. And actually did a very good job with the scientific method gathering data and creating these double-blind experiments, which sort of give some insight into that. So I recommend those books. They'll kind of open that door for you a little bit.
I might say I have his book on the afterlife on order. I listened to your interview with him. And one thing that struck me as being very important was the question he brought up, or you brought up, of reincarnation and persistence of the spirit rather than reincarnation or persistence of the spirit.
Yeah.
And I think that's a key thing I'm trying to understand now. How does it all work? And so I appreciate your interview with Dr. Schwartz and his great books, and I plan to read them.
Well, you know, there was kind of an unanswered question from that interview, and he's still working on it. And in fact, I think we're collaborating on it from a distance. But, you know, I saw John Edwards on television. I don't know anyone who hasn't. Amazing skill if there's no television or research trickery to it. And if you read the book, you'll see that every precaution was taken to rule that out. But I was curious as to the quality of the data, because every single interview, every single sitting, every single reading that he had related to the immediate family of the person who was alive. Now, these are deceased members of the person who's alive. But going along with your observation there about the persistence of the spirit, if that's true, and I believe there's a plethora of evidence throughout many civilizations that it is, then the spirit that made up the dearly departed has existed for a long, long time and has enjoyed multiple mortal existences. Why, then, doesn't John Edwards or the other mediums channel into the previous lifetimes of the departed? Why don't the departed come and say, and I existed in 1811 and 1512 and 695? We don't get any of that. That was my question, and that was the experiment that Dr. Schwartz is working on now.
Well, I can give you a thought on that. It's kind of like when my mother first mentioned to me the search for Bridie Murphy. Do you remember those books way back then about Bridie Murphy and her past lives and all that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about how this time and space thing is different in these dimensions we're talking about, which we really don't understand how they work, but we all have a feeling that they're there, multiple dimensions all around us. And a friend of mine in Australia, Rob Smith, mentioned a book to me last week called People Who Don't Know They're Dead, How They Attach Themselves to Unsuspecting Bystanders and What to Do About It. This book was written by Gary Hill, and I've ordered the book. I'll be interested to read this book. But perhaps with John Edwards, you know, these entities are still in that persistent state and not in that reincarnation state or in some, you know, I really can't answer how that may work, but I think it has to do with something, a space-time transience that we just don't understand yet.
Well, that's a really interesting observation, and I love that title, People Who Don't Know They're Dead. I've had bosses like that, I'm sure. The thing about it is that I have also met live people who were awake. They were enlightened and they were aware of knowledge that they brought forward from previous existences. It wasn't just deja vu either. I mean, they knew how to run equipment. They knew how to write music. They knew stuff that they just weren't taught in this lifetime, and they brought it forward with them with such skill that it was clear it was a memory and not just a talent. And so if there are live people who are, I mean, live, mortal, breathing, EKG-generating people that realize that they are these multiple dimensional beings, that they can actually bring time forward to them and maybe even see beyond the now, and hopefully they don't live there. We try to live in the now always. But there must also be deceased that have that knowledge, surely going through the veil and realizing, as many biblical characters do in the bosom of Abraham, that there's much to the existence of the spirit besides the dust-eating existence we enjoy as mortals. And I don't see that in the data. That's what was missing in the data. That's what caught my curiosity. And we'll go into that a little bit more tonight. But the viewpoint of your book gives you a unique theater that neurosurgeons in particular see, but certainly much more than the average person would ever see. You come closer to people who are on a pathway of leaving mortality more often than any other profession, I would think, other than maybe an emergency, an ambulance driver, so to speak, who might see things up close and personal in a traumatic way. But you see more of a drama unfolding and your interaction in trying to preserve that mortal existence. So in your explorations, your metaphysical explorations, you learned skills that went along with your, as you said, what did you say, heal by steel? Is that what it says in the book?
Yes, that's an old surgeon's adage, heal by steel. Heal with steel, meaning the surgical knife is the cure for everything. It's not a nice way to say things. Mostly general surgeons said that type of thing.
Yeah, I had a interview with Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's a medical school instructor. Wrote an awesome book called The Biology of Belief, but in his book he recounted another surgeon's placebo experience where he had done placebo knee surgeries. I mean, he actually did the incisions, but he didn't actually do the surgery. He sort of faked it with a video so the person believed that they had the surgery. No harm, no foul, I guess, but the bottom line is the people got better even though they didn't have the knee surgery. Now, that's really strange. So let's talk about, for the rest of this hour, the reality that there is a placebo effect, and we really don't know what causes it. You had a couple of remarkable cases in the first part of your book. Let's discuss those.
All right. Was there a particular one, Brooks?
What was it? The Vietnamese lady. What was her name?
Yes, Mrs. Dan Luk is the name I chose for her. Of all the people in my book, I was able to use real names and obtain permission, but this was one because in the years that followed, this lady eventually expired. But I chose, she was Vietnamese, and I chose the name Dam Luc. I don't know if that's for sure Vietnamese name, but it was able, I was able to close the chapter with that, as you know. And that case was striking because it was a case where a malignant tumor actually disappeared on MRI scanning and CT scanning, I mean, and it was all tied up with a very strange exercise in karma, and it opened my eyes to these things that I never thought were possible. You know, we say in surgery, not neurosurgery so much, but in surgery, a chance to cut is a chance to cure. That's another one of those adages, and medical doctors really look down on surgeons because of that attitude. Let's get it done, get it out, and get out of here. Whereas they take more time to really think over the situation since they're treating things medically rather than surgically. This particular case was a woman who was brought to me by a friend who I met earlier on, and this friend was a Zen Buddhist priest. And being that the lady was from Vietnam, he was trying to intercede in her care and get things going for her because her doctor had set her up for a scan for her headaches and found out that she had this large midline tumor. By midline, I meant deep in the brain in the middle, and it was obviously a malignancy of some type, not the highest grade malignancy, but nevertheless, it was something that was going to take her life in time. The treatment would be a combination of radiotherapy or chemotherapy, but to do that, the doctors needed a small piece of tumor. So I talked to the patient and her family, and I explained the surgery, how it would have to be done by going down between the hemispheres of her brain, taking a small piece for pathology, and once the diagnosis of malignancy was made, she would require, in my opinion, 6 weeks of radiation therapy. It's not that the surgery was so difficult, this is what we're trained to do, but it was a procedure that went well. And after she came to my office to set up everything, her friend called me aside, the Buddhist priest. And he said, I think you're probably wondering why these seven priests are here wearing those orange robes and carrying those beads and came in the room and sat in and listened to you. He said, I want to explain. And I said, well, John, I think they came to pray for the lady, but I have to tell you, in my experience, prayer is not going to get rid of this tumor. And he said, well, it's not that at all, Jack. And he said, that's why I want to tell you something. They didn't come to pray for her. They came to work with her on a karmic problem. And I said, well, what is that, John? Karmic problem she had. He said, the problem she had was an intense hatred and feelings for a particular woman friend of hers. And they feel that this hatred eventually manifested itself in a dis-ease, or dis-ease to you. But her not being at ease karmically and spiritually caused this invader in her brain, and they want her to realize that the only way she can recover is if she gives this up and truly gives it up. And to do that, they're working with her, taking her on what they call a guided meditation through the seven hell worlds, so she'll see what could be in store for her. And he said, you might see something when we come back in 6 weeks. Well, I wished him all the best, but I didn't think it was even going to be possible until 6 weeks later when she came back, Brooks. They came back with a follow-up scan, and as I put that on the board, I'm looking for this giant tumor that looked like a light bulb lighting up, and there was nothing. And I couldn't believe it. I looked at the ID tag, and it was the lady, and I called the radiologist, and I said, could you have this lady? He said, no. He said, look carefully. You see the results of your surgery in the bone and so forth. And I said, yeah, that's right, but where's the tumor? He said, that's what I wanted to know. He said, I've never seen that happen.
Now, we're not talking about a tumor the size of a pinto bean here, right?
A tumor the size of a lemon, let's say. A sizable tumor, and that's why I was so surprised. And the family and the monks acted like they knew all along this was going to be the result, and they were really just here to find out and then let me know. And there wasn't any hoopla or fanfare when they saw the results. They nodded knowingly, and they thanked me, and then they left. And John winked at me.
That's amazing. Now this was, of course, an inoperable tumor because it was like wrapped around both sides of her brain, right? It was deep in her brain.
Yes. Well, the corpus callosum that has, I don't know, a million or more fibers is the crossing area of the brain where left and right hemispheres interconnect. And it was a tumor growing right in or out of that area, and to remove it would have left her in worse shape. So it's not something we would try to remove. She would be completely disconnected, both halves of her brain, if she survived. So no, for a malignant tumor of any kind, a total removal is a good dream, but it usually does more harm than good.
Well, let me ask you a question. The biopsy, when they take the sample of the tumor, do the radiologists sort of practice with different wavelengths to see which one affects that particular mass the best?
No, I would say no. I think the literature is full of what radiation and what dose for most tumors, so I think they know this before they even start. What the pathologist does is to give the reading to the radiologist, so he has a go-ahead to know he's treating a definite malignancy and not some other strange thing. So I would say that's all been worked out in the past years.
Now, the incidence of collision with the photons that are beamed through the skull into the mass have a higher probability of hitting the cancerous tissue than they do healthy brain tissue, and so thus it's mostly absorbed by the cancerous cells and they die, right?
Well, there's also this thing of Bragg peak radiation, meaning as these photons, as you put, slow down, they emit another radiation that also helps. And I would say this for malignant tumors. Now, obviously, this lady's tumor was not the highest of the malignancies, which are common in adults, because I still don't know if that karmic thing could have worked out for her. But this was a lower-grade malignancy, which generally turns into a higher grade with time and usually is fatal. But I'd like to tell you briefly of a story about radiation and tumors and so forth to give you an idea of what we face when we're dealing with radiation and tumors and surgery.
Yeah.
There was a fellow on this island who was well-known. I had operated on him before. He was a police officer, and one day I was called to the emergency room, and there was a man there who looked at me, sat up in the bed, looked at me, and whatever question I asked him, he could either answer with a yes or a no. It didn't make any difference. If I asked him what his name was, he would say yes, and does he have any headache, he would still say yes, and whatever question. His CAT scan was normal, red as normal, but trying to piece this together and the fact that he had elevated temperature, I ordered another scan the next morning, and indeed there was a thin rim of fluid, which turned out to be an infection, and he improved after surgery, and years went by, and we kept in touch, but then he developed another problem, I'd say 10 or 12 years later. He had a car accident, and trying to figure out why, they realized he had a field cut, or part of his visual field was missing, unbeknownst to him. Well, this led to another scan and a diagnosis, this time of a tumor. This time the most common tumor of an adult brain is called a glioblastoma. That's a high-grade tumor. And unfortunately, generally when we see a patient with that, we know that the longevity with and without treatment, the survival is going to be on the order of a year. And it's a very fatal thing. And I've tried everything for that tumor, from surgery, radiation, to shark cartilage, without any results at all. But I told the wife I was going to a conference in San Diego, and I would take his films along just in case anything new came up with the treatment of glioblastoma, such as gene therapy and all these new things. Well, I talked with a good friend of mine who was a staff doctor at the Cleveland Clinic when I trained, and he said, "Jack, let me just tell you something about this tumor." He said, "I'm fortunate that in Florida we have all of these high-tech pieces of equipment. We can localize something, you know, as small as a couple of BBs within the brain, and we can focus radiation therapy precisely after surgery." He said, "I saw the wife of a golf pro who brought her in with a tumor like this, but it was very tiny, extremely tiny. We use something called the Stealth System." He continued that your friend Dr. Bakken, who, by the way, lives on this island, his company has put this out. Bakken was the man who invented the cardiac pacemaker, Brooks. I don't know if you're familiar with Earl Bakken. But no. At any rate, he's gotten into neurosurgical equipment and orthopedic equipment, and the Stealth System allows you to really pinpoint an area of the brain and guide you to it. He said, "I removed all of that tumor, Jack. It was small, but we got it all out, and then we got a nice rim of tissue around it to make sure. We put her through focused radiation therapy right on that spot. And she came back a year later with half a dozen new lesions all over her brain. He said, I'm afraid there's nothing we can do for your friend. So that's the problem with radiation, with brain tumors, the malignant ones. But in that case, you asked me to explain of the lady with a malignant tumor. It was gone after 6 weeks of radiation, and it wasn't a pinto bean, as you say. This was a good-sized tumor, but yet and still, there was no evidence. And she, my understanding is she lived several more years.
That's amazing. I mean, of course, you know, in the medical profession, you would call that a miracle. But as you said, the monks were no more surprised by that than they were the sun coming up the next day. To them, it was a karmic principle that was true and unwavering, and they applied it, and their job was done. I guess my question is, how does the human body generate an unwelcome environment for a cancerous cell like that where it leaves by just changing the consciousness of the mortal body or of the spirit inside the body?
My recent encounter with my friend Martin, I had hoped to see a similar type of cure. He was a gentleman that I corresponded with every day on the internet through instant messaging or emails or sometimes on the phone, and he made 3 visits here, and I met him through remote viewing. Several people who were interested came to meet me, but I kept in touch with all of them, but especially Martin, because he liked the same type of things I liked. Well, when he became ill, the problem eventually turned out to be a problem with his liver. And as I planned to make the journey to London in January, Robert Bruce and another good friend of mine, Rosemary Clark, you read about her in that chapter, The Temple in Man in Egypt, right, Brooks?
Right.
Yeah, they both told me, listen, it's amazing that, first of all, the liver can be a seat of repressed emotions, and you need to work with Martin on that. And I said, yes, I'm going to sit down and work with him and see if there's any kind of karmic or other things that could apply. And Rosemary, who's researching her new book that has to do with the Dogon tribe in Mali and the Egyptians, said, gee, you know, Jack, that's amazing. I just found out there was a special vessel they used to hold the liver because they felt the same way back then the ancients felt about this whole thing. But unfortunately, it was not to be. Before I had a chance to sit down and talk with Martin, things progressed rapidly with the colon tumor metastatic to his liver and then beyond. So it wasn't something that was going to be rectified that way, unfortunately. But I do think there's a way that if we start ahead of time, we can eliminate things that will lead to a dis-ease and things such as a tumor and perhaps extend our longevity quite a bit.
Well, it's clear that there is some truth to the idea, or at least some data to support the idea, that, shall we call it, the vibrational level of the spirit of the person inside the body. You mentioned that Damluk had some hatred for a woman that it just literally, you know, burned a place inside of her, according to these monks, and that had created some kind of negative energy inside of her that allowed this tumor to get a foothold. And then you have people that have a very bright, very loving, outgoing, forgiving, merciful nature, and they tend to live, you know, long and disease-free lives, but it doesn't always work out that way. I'm just saying that the propensity for it is there. A sour person usually has a lot of health problems, and a bright and cheerful person does not. There was, in particular, especially in the chapter Temple in Man, because she was working with Egyptologists, specifically Renee Schwaller de Lubitz, who was, you know, a great student of the temple in Luxor and discovered that there was some correlation between the structure of that temple and the human body. And there was a discovery, and I don't know if it was Martin or it was another one of your patients, that she clued you into sort of by mistake, just because of her research on that temple. Tell us how that went.
Rosemary Clark has a love of ancient Egypt, and she has studied it quite a bit. She's also an astrologer, which she knows quite a bit about, too. And she was a lady married to a man named Gary Lyon, who's a good friend of mine also now, and was also a great guitarist and a singer and musician. I met them because they were living in Hilo, and Gary wanted to use my recording studio. He wanted to rent it, actually, to perfect his music, which was a soundtrack for a slideshow given presented by Rosemary and Gary for her work with A Traveler's Guide to Ancient Egypt. She did the illustrations for that book, and they wanted to promote it using the slideshow. Well, Mr. Lyon was such a pleasant fellow, and I did have a recording studio, but I was so busy during the day and most nights working. I said, here, Gary, you take this and use what you want to perfect your work, which he did. And it came out great, and he made several commercials and left me a nice tape of all that. Well, when they left Hilo, they moved to Honolulu for some reasons that they had to switch their living place. And during the time I was studying hard for my oral boards in neurosurgery, she developed a problem, and that problem was pain behind her eye. I believe it was the right eye. And she called me to ask me my opinion of that, and I told her to look in the mirror and tell me if her eyelid was dropped down. That's what we call ptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S, meaning a droop of the eyelid. Then I also asked her to look at the pupil of her eye, because diabetes can affect both, but if there's pressure on what we call the third nerve leading to the eye out of three cranial nerves that supply the eye, the pupil won't be affected, perhaps, in diabetes, but may be changed when there's pressure on the nerve. And indeed, she said the pupil looked larger on that side. So I called a friend in Honolulu. I arranged for her to go and see him and have at their institution and have a CAT scan as soon as possible, because I thought there's something causing pressure that needed to be resolved. And indeed, she said they told her she had a mass and they weren't sure what it was and they wanted to do an angiographic study. And during that phone call, she said, well, by the way, Jack, she said, I'm working on a book. I'm working on a book about ancient Egypt. And do you remember the book by Swallard de Lewitt that talked about the temple in Luxor being outlined according to the body? And I thought you'd be interested in the brain section. I said, yes, that was about a year ago. I have the book. But she said, well, could you send it back now? Because I really need to look up some things at some point. So I mailed it back to her, and then the experience you're talking about that she had was this. She called me, and she said, Jack, I had the angiogram study that they wanted to do where the dye was injected into the blood vessel in my groin and a catheter was run up. So they could see the arteries of the brain filling up and find out what this lesion was. And she said, you know, I told them before I had the study what was wrong, and they laughed at me. She said, here's what happened, Jack. She said, after you sent the book back, that very night I had a dream. And in the dream, I heard your voice in my ear as clear as I'm talking to you now. You said, Rosemary, it's at the transept of the temple. She said, I awoke. I turned on the light, and there was a package. We had mailed the book back. She said, I opened it up, and I looked up. Where is this transept of the temple? And there it was, the cavernous sinus of the brain. So she said, Jack, I told these people. I said, I know what you're going to find, and I smiled at him. She said, you're going to find an aneurysm in the cavernous sinus on the right side. And they were shocked that I would even know the word cavernous sinus, Jack, she continued. She said, but sure enough, that's what it was, a giant aneurysm in the cavernous sinus, and they're going to operate. Well, the amazing thing about this, Brooks, is that about the time she was developing her symptoms, the pain and the droop of the eyelid, I was studying for that board exam. This was in 1986. And I took a month off work, and during that time I would eat a nice breakfast, healthy breakfast, protein. I would go for a walk of a couple, 3-4 miles, and just get my mind right. I would come back and study the next 12 hours. I did that for a month. Then I thought, what is the most difficult thing that I could be asked how to manage? And I knew what it was. It was bilateral aneurysms of the cavernous sinus. That would be a tough thing for any neurosurgeon. And I took one day on that. And sure enough, that's about the time that she was having her symptoms. So I went over to see her scan. I happened to be on that island for another purpose, but I was at the hospital. And I went in, asked them to put up her films on the alternator for me so I could just take a look at this And as it rose up, you know, these things hold about, I don't know, a dozen films in rows. And as it came up, this thing looked like a tarantula in her brain. And then this word came in my mind, like, Hosobushi, Hosobushi. If someone had stood there next to me and said, what do you think? Do you think Hosobushi could handle that? I would say, well, I don't know. I don't remember Hosobushi. But sure enough, I got home. I looked up the books where I was studying for this aneurysm of the cavernous sinus, and there was a paper by Yoshio Hosobushi about his 7 cases of giant aneurysms in the cavernous sinus and how it's treated by cardiac standstill procedure, stopping the blood flow, cooling the body, and directly opening that area to be able to repair that during the few minutes you have to work. And during that few minutes, the patient is legally brain dead. There's no electrical activity of the brain. And she came out of that perfectly. And later on, when she had finished her first book called The Sacred Tradition in Ancient Egypt, I was pleased to see that she had dedicated that book to me. I've never had anyone do such a kind thing for me. And then she went on to write more books on ancient Egypt and several other books. So that's how it all worked. Something strange with that word, Hosobushi. And later, even a couple years later, I found myself standing next to him in surgery, assisting him on a case here in Hawaii, because he had made the move from California to Hawaii. It's all very strange. And it makes me wonder, Brooks, if maybe if we get to talk about parallel universes, what does happen? In a case of Mrs. Damn Luck, was it really karma, or was it that somehow I managed to kind of ease into another parallel future that was like I wanted it to be? What do you think about that, Brooks?
Oh, yeah, we're going to cover that in the third hour. That's for sure. That's right. We're definitely going to get off in that. I just have a couple of questions before we wrap up this hour, because the story is so fascinating, because Rosemary, studying De Lubitz's book, and the funny thing about this book, I think it's, if it's The Temple and Man, is it the big book? It's like a big two-volume set?
No, that big one costs about $100. This is a smaller one that's affordable, small. But I know the big one you're talking about.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, De Lubitz spent the, you know, like 7 years in this one temple in Luxor, and sure enough, it is laid out in the golden mean, just like the human body. In fact, you can almost lay a human body over it. But in his immensely detailed writings of the structure, the anatomy of the human body is laid out in granite. By the, we think, the ancient Egyptians. My opinion is they inherited the darn thing. But the fact that she said, or that you said, transept of the temple, that's fascinating, that she actually went into the surgeon with knowledge that she had gained from a structure, or the analysis of a structure, in ancient Egypt. That is the fascinating thing about the story.
Yes, and also, the fact was that at that clinic, they had planned to operate on her in what would be another approach to that area by doing a craniotomy, removing the bone of the skull, going down to find that aneurysm and clip it. But without that cardiac standstill, Dr. Hosobushi felt that it could rupture and that she should come make an emergency visit to California and let him try this new procedure. And
wow.
Interestingly enough, in the book, do you recall the case of Pam Reynolds? Dr. Spessler's case of another patient who had this exact cardiac standstill procedure at his institution, the Barrow Neurologic Co-Institution in Phoenix. So now the top neurosurgeons can do that procedure that requires a cardiac team and so forth. But this strange thing in Rosemary's case not only was related to ancient Egypt, it was something that saved her life, because had she had the surgery the routine way, it was felt that that aneurysm would have ruptured, and that would have been it. So
yeah,
came
yeah, an arterial opening, and you can't stop it.
Oh,
wow.
True. It's difficult.
Amazing stuff. Just so fascinating. Remember, Earth Explorers, this is a three-hour program, but it goes by in about 15 minutes. So if you want to make any phone calls, use the numbers for Station 2 at bbsradio.com, or go to xsquaredradio.com and use the phone lines there. We're going to keep the phone lines open for Hour 2 and Hour 3. And my guest tonight is Dr. Jack Turner, and his book is medicine, miracles, and manifestations. And we will be back in about 3 minutes. We'll take a short musical break, let you go to the fridge, and we'll be back after this with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. We're glad you're here with us. We would not be here without you. My guest tonight is Dr. John L. Turner, author of Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. This is an incredible interview tonight, and we're actually going over his book, but also we're going to be getting into the more metaphysical this hour, and then in the last hour we're going to talk about the possibility of parallel universes, and maybe what we can do to alter the sheet of paper upon which we traverse through space and time. And we want you to stick with us through that. So please give us a call. Phone lines will be open this hour and next hour. And don't forget to visit our affiliates. We have added Moose Jaw, making outdoor living pleasurable without roughing it. And if you're getting out in the sun, in the water, you're going to be surfing or diving or skiing, check out Wetsuit Warehouse for us. Excellent affiliate that we just recently added. And I also want you to put on your calendar June 19th through the 21st. This is the live H2O concert. It'll be in 26 cities. The unique thing about this, Dr. Leonard Horowitz and his colleagues have determined scientifically and mathematically that the frequency 528 hertz is the vibration of love, which can be transmitted harmoniously through water, the universal conductor of energy. So through their combined knowledge has come an opportunity to present an experiment that has the potential to bring about transformation on a global scale. Don't miss it. It's called the Live H2O, and you can get to it by livehto.org or livehtounitedbylove.com. The link is on the website at X Squared Radio. Don't pass it up. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. All right, here we go. Hour two, X Squared Radio. Tune in and get squared. Record sea ice growth rates have happened after a record low. May sound surprising at first, but it is not completely unexpected. The more ice that survives the summer melt, the less open water there is for new ice to grow. When summertime ice extent hits a record low, on the other hand, large areas of open water provide room for the ice to grow once temperatures get cold enough. While summer warming of the upper ocean surface can cause wintertime sea ice regrowth to lag initially, as the fall season progresses and sunlight weakens, the rate of energy loss from the ocean increases. This heat loss, coupled with a large area of open water, creates ideal conditions for sea ice to form rapidly over large areas. We felt the definition was necessary because the sea ice in the Arctic is increasing at the rate of 58,000 square miles a day up there. Those of you that think global warming is exhausting the Arctic, it is having its effect, but the Arctic is fighting back. It is midnight on September 22nd, 2012, and the skies above Manhattan are filled with a flickering curtain of colorful light. Few New Yorkers have seen the aurora this far south, but their fascination is short-lived. Within a few seconds, electric bulbs dim and flicker, then become unusually bright for a fleeting moment. Then, all the lights in the state go out. Within 90 seconds, the entire eastern half of the U.S. is without power. It sounds ridiculous, and there's a movie out called The Knowing. You might want to go see it, see a graphic display of how that can happen. It sounds ridiculous, but surely the sun couldn't create so profound a disaster on Earth. Yet an extraordinary report, funded by NASA and issued by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in January this year, claims it could do just that. Just thought you should know. We'll keep you posted on that, too. We always give you the solar activity during the first minutes each Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Pacific, right here on X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Jack.
Hi, Brooks.
All right, this hour is a transition hour. We do allow telephone calls. People will call in from who knows where, maybe even as far as Japan. And we'll continue that for the third hour. In our first hour, we talked about several medical cases and amazing metaphysical solutions that seem to be put into place in your book that you talk about in detail and are completely fascinating, the book Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. First of all, tell our listeners what's the best way to get your book?
The book can be obtained from, I'd like to tell you it can be obtained from any bookstore, but that's probably not the case, but from retailers such online as Amazon.com, Target, Barnes & Noble, or even from the publisher New Page Books. So there are many ways, and either from your website or from my website, a link will take them to Amazon, and they can read about the book. But I would recommend my website because first they can read about the book to see if it's something they'd really be interested in, their chapter, summaries, and so forth. And I know, Brooks, you like synchronicity quite a bit. And during that commercial, I heard a sound tune about gentle rain and so forth, and it started raining here in Hilo. This is the rainiest city in the U.S., so it's nothing uncommon. But you mentioned also about 528 hertz, and yesterday I had just posted a blog. I wanted to post something for the day, but it had to be short because I was trying to study. And it's a 528 hertz DNA repair program that a friend on TBD, TBD means to be determined. It's a nice type of forum where people can discuss spirituality, consciousness, and many things. And if someone would go to that link, if they just click on View Blogs, and they'll go right to that, it's a DNA healing frequency, they can click that picture of the DNA and hear this and see this visual program that does relate to that 528 hertz, just as you said. So I wanted to at least mention that. And one other thing, Brooks, before we get into the second hour, I want to tie up something on that first hour and on that disease business. And you mentioned sometimes people are sailing through life without a problem and others are really struggling. Do you remember that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, my mother passed about a year ago, and I was very lucky to, fortunate to have the last 5 years with her here at home in Hilo. She moved over here, and she died at age almost 99. And I always wondered, why did she have such an easy life? No disease except Alzheimer's during those last 5 years, which actually, even though she got to the point where she couldn't understand how bad this was for her, I got to truly see her live in the now, as her memory was only good for perhaps a minute at the most during much of that last year. And I thought about her life and how she always took time to help people whenever they asked. And I think that's the key, to show that love for people whenever you can. I've learned it also on that TBD forum when someone first told me about that movie, Pay It Forward. Now, I must be a slow learner because I hadn't heard about that movie. But a friend told me, try this movie and see what you think. We all should be paying it forward. And indeed, that movie, followed by the movie 7 Pounds, which is a retroactive study in Pay It Forward, helped me quite a bit. So I think one way to eliminate that disease is to get to the point where we're constantly aware of other people who need that helping hand. And this is nothing new. Epictetus, the Greek philosopher, said it long ago. And briefly, I want to tell you one of his great quotes was, "To accuse others for one's own misfortunes is a sign of want of education. To accuse oneself shows that one's education has begun. And then finally, to accuse neither oneself nor others shows that one's education is complete." So great thinkers have always known that what we have to do is to be aware of what's going on and realize that we've got to have the courage and the ability to try to change those things that can be changed, but things cannot be changed, to realize that and not bump our heads, and then to really show that love. That's what I wanted to get in.
Yeah, and you know, you have an excellent story about that in your book. You were chatting with a woman named, was it Teresa or Teresa? And you had a trauma case come in the ER. Why don't you flash that story by us really quick and see how you awakened to the idea that maybe you should try to help everybody.
Yeah. There was a time before I came to Hawaii that in Cleveland, when working at a major hospital as a resident on call, I knew that a full moon was going to be a bad night. I knew that New Year's Eve was going to be a bad night with all kinds of trauma from accidents to gunshots. And people would come in really smashed up and banged up, and there was almost no way to pull them out of that. And there are times when you knew that to be aggressive and all out may just leave the patient on a respirator and worse. So you had to kind of do a balancing act. And when the Internet was in its infancy, I remember paying like $400 or $500 a month to get a hookup from Hawaii. And it was all new to me, and I started out with America Online because that chat room thing was kind of nice to hear that You've Got Mail thing come in, like Sleepless in Seattle movie and all that. And one day I'm watching these people chat. I'm what you would call a lurker, I guess, just watching other people, not getting involved. And I just saw this person who called the name Teresa C. That's all I knew about her. And I said, "Hello." And she answered, "Well, who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm in Hawaii, and I'm a brain surgeon, and I was looking at some of your things related that sounded like to the body and brain." She said, well, brain surgeon, sure, I'll bet. She said, I'm a rocket scientist. And I said, well, I am too, which wasn't much of a stretch. I did work for the Rocket Research Lab as an undergraduate student. But to make a long story short, we began to chat every day about all kind of things. And I sent her some, her mother, my tape brain sounds of the Pacific that uses the hemisync signal to synchronize the brain, and they appreciated that, and I helped her husband get a job with the police department in Detroit, as I had a good friend in Detroit. But one day, as we were chatting, I get a call from the emergency room, and I'm typing and chatting and talking on the phone, and the doctor is telling me about a case of a gunshot wound to the brain who's in critical condition, and I said, well, I'll be in to see him, and asked for the lab data and stuff, and the lady on the other end in Detroit now said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go see him eventually, but let me finish talking with you, and then I'll drive in and see what's going on. And she said, well, aren't you going to rush in there? And I said, well, you know, I found that, first of all, someone may have a right to kill themselves, and second of all, sometimes when a bullet hits the brain like that, there's not much you can do. And she said, well, if I was having a bad day and you were on call, I'd be in trouble, wouldn't I? I said, well, I said, I see your point. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go in there, and I'm even going to go through some red lights. I'm going to get there quick. I'm going to do what has to be done, and I think I could probably extend his life. But I tell you what, will you send him a card every day while he's there? She said, absolutely. I said, well, I'm out. And I left, and I went. I examined the boy, and I helped him out. He was in his early 30s and did the surgery, repaired everything, and eventually he woke enough to the point where he could get to a rehab hospital, and then I didn't hear any more from him, but she always sent a card every day like she promised. The key thing about this case, what I learned later, the years ago, a girlfriend named Lucinda told me that she had a job taking care of this man on another island, and her job as kind of a nursing assistant was to help him out at home. And he told her how grateful he was to be alive. And that made me realize I didn't have the right to play God with things. I need to do what has to be done in the best possible way I could do it, and realize there are forces greater than me that need to get to work on things. And that's how that story helped me.
You know, you mentioned a few minutes ago the catchphrase, to be determined. And I thought that was very poignant in light of this hour's subject matter. We're going to talk about determination and, you know, the teleology of human existence. That is to say, is there some grand pattern or some destiny that's laid out for each one of us from which we cannot waver no matter how hard we tug against the chain? And if so, are there parallel destinies that we can move between? But let's solve the first one first. Let's talk about how you began to apply metaphysics in the treatment of neurological disorders.
How it first happened. Well, that's tough to think back. What would the first example might be? When I talked to a family about stopping a respirator in the case of the very first surgery I did on this island, and if you don't mind, I think I'd like to briefly discuss that case, because that was the start of everything, and it happened
sure.
In 1981 April, about almost this time, where every year on this island there's a festival called the Merry Monarch Festival, where various hula groups come to this island and they compete for synchronized hula dancing. And I had come to Hilo that year. I saw the job that time when I came over, and I realized this was the place for me. And on July 4th, my family and I moved. I was married at that time with two sons. And on August 3rd was my first day on call. But waiting for all the instruments I had ordered that the Hilo Medical Group kindly ordered for me, they didn't come in. There was a tugboat strike, and they were stuck on the dock somewhere. And all that was available for that first surgical case was a hand drill, which the listeners can visualize a brace and bit that looked like that, and that was pretty standard in the old days of Dr. Cushing, but, you know, I was trained with high-speed things. But Dr. William Hunt, a world-famous neurosurgeon, recommended that his residents know the old way, And he made us do it that way. And as a medical student, I was able to do cases using that hand drill. That wasn't the problem. The problem was there was no way to cut between the drill holes to turn a flap, so to speak. No kind of old-fashioned wire saw or power saw. So I had to bite off the bone with something that looked like a pair of pliers just to get enough room to relieve a blood clot on a young man who came in with an acute, what we call subdural hematoma, acute bleeding between the covering of the brain and the brain. That can carry a mortality as high as 50%, but in that case, 90%. We had no CT scan here on the island for the first 2 years I was here, so it was really rough doing these things. But at any rate, I did the surgery. I tried to relieve the pressure, or I did relieve the pressure, but unfortunately, with the time constraints and everything, he eventually blew a pupil. That's our term for dilated his pupil, showing that the brain was being forced through the foramen magnum, the opening at the base of the skull, and that the chance of survival was rare. And then he blew his other pupil and became in the brain dead, basically, without any response, any respirations. And I recommended to the family that because of this, to keep him maintained on the machines may not be best for him, but they just couldn't really understand, and they preferred to wait and asked me, would I just wait this out? Well, I did. And then one night, I would say a few days later, I had a dream in which I was making rounds on this young man, and as I stood looking at him, he suddenly triggered the respirator, meaning he took a breath on his own. And I couldn't believe it. And as I watched him start to breathe, I woke up realizing this man might make it from this brain-dead state. It was amazing. I called the hospital right away. It was about 5 in the morning, and they said, well, no, doctor, there's no change in your patient. I'm sorry. And I told the nurse about the dream, and I said, I wish it could have been. Well, that morning I went into work. I made rounds at the hospital, and as I stood there by the young man's bed, and I watched the tear flow from his eye, I'm thinking, that's a reflex action, but I wish he could take a breath. And suddenly he took a breath, Brooks. It was, right, the timing was perfect.
Wow.
And the nurse looked at me, and she said, that was your dream. And I said, well, wait a minute. And he took another breath. And I said, this is unbelievable, and I made some adjustments on the respirator to try to build up the carbon dioxide to see if it would stimulate his breathing, but unfortunately, it didn't, and he didn't take any more breaths, and that was it. I talked to the family. I explained to them about everything, including the dream, but I thought that it was best if they consider discontinuing their respiratory support, and this time they agreed. And sure enough, I did that, and after about 20 minutes, you can see the heart goes flatline and everything is over with. Well, a day or two later, I got a call from his father, who was on the mainland, who said he was on his way to Hawaii and wanted to talk to me about his son. So I made an appointment scheduled for him in my office, and he came in to sit down, and he said, Doctor, I understand my son visited you before. And I said, no, sir, I'm afraid I never knew your son until the day of his injury. He said, I don't mean that. He said, your dream. And I was surprised. I said, well, he said, well, the nurses, of course, told me, and that's when I made arrangements to come here and speak with you because I want you to know the meaning of that. And I said, well, sir, I'm really sorry he didn't make it off that respirator. That was the dream. He said, no, we don't look at it that way. As Hawaiians, we feel that this was his way of contacting you, to ask you to let him go, you know, to do what was necessary to stop this life support so he could move on. And he said, you see how it worked out. You talked with the rest of the family, and suddenly they understood. And that dream contact is the reason. He said, I think that you're destined to do big things for the people here, and I think you should know this at the beginning. So, Brooks, that was the first of many different kind of metaphysical events, and this was, I would have to say, that was the start, the very first case in Hilo.
So you became convinced, or at least aware now, that there was some way for even a flatlined person to somehow reach you spiritually, or at least make a signal, a sign to you. And becoming aware that there's, you know, more to the human than meets the knife, so to speak. You also became aware that there are ways of sharing the energy of other masters, other teachers, or other sources with the patient and helping them to recover. So how did you become acquainted with Okada?
Okada, you're referring to Mokichi Okada, a man who was born in 1882 and died in 1955. And he was a man, a Japanese man, who in Tokyo as a youth was told he would die from tuberculosis. There wouldn't be a cure. He had developed an eye disease when he wanted to be an artist, and pictures of him show a ptosis of his eye, the word we've talked about. And he had some type of double vision that kind of messed up his plans to be an artist. And trying to do jewelry work, lacquerware, he lacerated a tendon of his finger that controls the wheel that spins the gold onto the wet lacquer. And his wife, one wife died in childbirth, and he said there must be some type of spiritual world that can answer this. And his life is about reaching a level of enlightenment that told him what the spiritual world was all about. The way I, so to speak, met Mr. Okada was very interesting. It had to do with a group here that has been practicing spiritual healing in Hilo for over 50 years. They've been practicing this according to Mokichi Okada's philosophy on eating natural food, the appreciation of art and beauty, and emitting a spiritual light energy from the palm of the hand. And the way I heard about it was on a day that Father Damien's bones returned to Hawaii, at least the bones of his hand. And I'm sure most people are familiar with this man who now is being made a saint. And it's felt there were power in the bones. And one day, getting out of surgery, I had this strange feeling of stopping to decide, which way do I go? Do I go down the left hallway or to the right or what? I've never stood outside surgery and tried to think of that, but this day I did, and something led me to the right. And sure enough, at the end of the hallway, my friend Katie, a ward clerk in surgery, was coming on her way to the restroom. I would have missed her the other way, and she said, "Did you get that package from Mr. Kikuchi?" And I said, "Well, what is that?" She said, "Left at your office." I said, "You know, I did see some kind of package in the pile of stuff, but what was that?" She said, "Well, you remember the word moa?" And that's spelled M-O-A, and in Hawaiian it means chicken, but it stands for Mokichi Okada Association. And I said, "Yes, I've heard that strange word." 2 years ago, when in surgery, a nurse said, "Dr. Turner, what do you know about MOA?" And I turned around, and she had her hand extended towards me, palm out. I said, "Well, what is that?" She said, "There are people who heal without touching." I said, "No, I haven't heard of that." And 2 years went by, and now in the hallway, I hear, "Have you heard the word MOA?" So I said, "Well, tell your friend Kikuchi who left that I'll get back to him in a couple of weeks. I'll look that over." And it wasn't long before I sat down to look at that package with another friend, and sure enough, there were things in there about light being emitted from the body, something I'd never heard of, ultraviolet light as well as visible light, things about plants and how they're in touch with human emotions, something that I never had a green thumb at all. I never knew about that. And then the third thing was the eating of natural foods, which Okada felt was less for the body to detoxify. It all made sense to me. And before you know it, things happened that I became involved in this type of healing work and researching their work, and I'm still involved to this present day in that particular type of healing. So it all happened by what I thought at the time was coincidence, but now I know it was the plan unfolding for me to be involved with healing using a spiritual light energy in addition to the techniques that we learn in Western medicine, such as surgery and medications. That's how it happened, Brooks.
Well, the idea that the human body emits ultraviolet radiation or ultraviolet light, that it fluoresces or that it phosphoresces depending on the energy level of the being itself, I think Mr. Kurlian developed some high-voltage photographic techniques that sort of confirm that there's an energy aura around the body, and there are some digital photography and even Polaroid photographies that are out there for aura imaging. But the idea of being able to transmit or to broadcast that energy in a focused way from one body to another in a manner that would promote healing. Is there some training that goes with this? Is there a level that you have to reach? Can anybody do it?
Well, kind of like remote viewing. They say, can anyone do it? And my answer to that was, all it takes is a human brain. This business about healing with light, as far as Mokichi Okada, and the word for it is Jorei, J-O-H-R-E-I, which in Japanese means uplifting of the spirit. And Okada, what happened to him during his enlightenment process, and as he developed more and more knowledge about the spiritual world with metaphysical events that were happening, he reached the point where suddenly he had what he described as a 4-centimeter sphere of light energy that somehow lodged within his abdomen. And only later, while he was in a prison cell, did the spirit of Kanon, a Japanese entity spirit, came to lodge within that light. But at any rate, he noticed that people he was trying to heal with hands-on healing were getting better. He had tried most of his life to get involved with various forms of healing, but now something had changed. And I read an interesting monograph of someone who knew him in life, who said as they would wait by the side of the road for him to appear for one of his talks, when he walked by, it was like a wave of warmth, a wave of energy that passed by them. So something was going on with this man, Okada. And he said, look, whatever happened to me, he said, I'll say in a similar word, as Jesus said, all of you can do what I'm doing and even better. He said, there's nothing special except this. He said, if I take a pen, and as an artist, I know that if I write the kanji for hikari, which means light, he said, as strange as this may sound, something metaphysical travels into the molecules of the ink. And if I fold this paper up and give it to you and you have it with you, it will link you to me with a spiritual cord of some type that will allow you to transmit this same God-given light energy that I have. And he said, I have enough light for 1 million people. And he wrote these symbols, and they gave them to people. And in fact, I have one in a locket around my neck now that inside it has this symbol, Hikari, which means light. And being linked to Okada is the theory that people who wear this amulet called the Ohakari, which is an honorific form of Hikari, they're linked with Okada. And as they're giving this Jorei treatment, which is done at a distance, he felt the optimum distance was 31 centimeters from the person. And he wrote out all the key points for different diseases, hypertension, diabetes, etc. And he said, let this energy flow and realize it's not a matter of faith. He said, just let it flow and you watch the results. So this is one type of energy healing that does not involve intention. And as I had mentioned earlier on other shows, the Spindrift experiments with non-goal-directed prayer, this would be more of a type of a non-goal-directed healing. Just let that energy flow and let it do its best possible work. But that's how I heard about Okada. This is how I learned about cells of the body emitting light, from books such as The Secret Life of Plants and Dr. Douglas's book, Into the Light, about that. And most of the light is emitted from the hand, and interestingly enough, Brooks, emitted from the fingernails of the hand. And we know that now by the sensitive instruments that the astronomers use for light detection. So it's all been verified, and more papers come out on this every day. I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, we our hands are very sensitive, especially the fingertips, with millions of nerve endings there, and we can sense very, very fine textures, almost as fine as we can with the tongue. When I travel in Egypt, around different areas, all the hieroglyphs, all the paintings and reliefs that you see, there's a lot of using the hands in sort of a 45-degree angle, palm forward kind of, I'm beaming something into your back or your forehead or something with my hands. And that goes back a long, long time. I guess my question is, how do you feel when you're doing it, when you're actually broadcasting the light energy through your hands with availability and with whatever ability and aptitude you've developed? How do you feel when you're doing it?
Brooks, you were kind to say you read my book not once but twice, and you remember the story of a Dr. von Elsener?
Yes.
All right. Now, that's an interesting story. Maybe you'll ask me more about that, but let me tell you the part I want to tell you about him. As a psychologist, he told me that he would never believe in anything spiritual.
Right.
But because he felt he loved me like a brother, he was willing to obtain this Ohikari go on a trip to Japan with me and so forth. But I have a video I made of him on that trip to Japan explaining to people how he never thought he would believe in anything spiritual, and he held up his hand. He said, yet when he gives jore to someone, he feels the heat himself in his hand. And he said he was absolutely astounded at anything like that sensation he would feel. When I've done it, Brooks, I don't notice anything like that at all. My concentration would be on directing the energy where it should go, for Okada's writings. But many of the recipients of this will feel a heat of some type. They'll notice something. And to say what that means, I'm not sure, but you will remember the case of the man who had Christmas disease and how his son, a cardiac pump technician who thought he was really a scientific kind of a guy, had to tell me that he saw this light coming from the hand of a person giving jore to his father. So to say how it all means, I don't think, in my case, I've felt anything, but the people do feel that. They experience some type of a heat reaction.
Yeah, that was an interesting story. By the way, the Christmas disease mentioned in the book is a form of hemophilia. You lack a clotting factor, and this particular patient was being treated by actually two MOA visitors each day. And even though the blinds were drawn, I guess they were kind of like Venetian blinds, members of the family outside that room say that they saw light behind the blinds moving with the MOA administrator's hands.
Well, it wasn't quite like that. It was more that they were in the room next to the bed, and the blinds were drawn so there wasn't a bright light coming through the window.
Oh,
so
I see.
Subdued lighting, but then they could see as they watched the jore being administered, they could see what they thought was a light emitting from the hand. Now, I don't know if that was wishful thinking or not, but they felt they should share that story with me.
Well, I find it interesting that you don't have to be a trained Zen master. You don't have to be a Jesus. Although when you read the stories in the Bible, especially the one where Jesus is walking through a very crowded town, his fame as a healer had spread, and certainly there was a need in every community that he and the apostles visited. And the crowd was really pressing in on him, and one woman who had an issue of blood, could have been hemophilia, hard to know what the exact disease was, but she had the faith that if she just touched the hem of his garment that she would be healed. Now, that much is remarkable enough, but the really remarkable thing is that when she reached forward through the crowd and touched the hem of his garment, she received a healing. And Jesus, it's recorded, says he felt virtue go out of him. He felt energy drain out of him. And he commented, "Who touched me?" And, of course, the apostles were saying, "What do you mean, who touched you? We're being pressed in on all sides. We're having to elbow people out of the way. What do you mean, who touched me?" He said, No, somebody touched me, and I felt virtue go out of me, and I want to know who it was, and she needs to come forward. And it was an example in the scriptures that there was actually a physical movement of energy from Jesus to the woman, which performed the healing according to her desires. And maybe that's what's happening here. This life energy, this healing energy, Jorai, Hikari, is moving from Okada-san posthumously through the people and into these patients. And you are a testament that kind of healing is taking place and that it does work.
Well, that's interesting. That's really interesting. But I think maybe the reason I say I don't feel anything is because this energy, supposedly from Okada in the spiritual world now, is not really, I'm not really modifying it or incorporating it. I'm just kind of letting it pass on. That's the belief in people who do jore, that this is not their energy at all. They're not doing anything other than directing it where it needs to go. And to me, it's related to the form of giving. I've done a little blogging and discussions about the highest form of giving when I first came across this and trying to study the Jewish Kabbalah. If we have time, I'd like to mention what that is about high giving, because I think this is how healing works. I think it's all involved with with showing love and by giving of yourself to help someone out.
I think that would be excellent.
All right. The Kabbalah posed this question, and I was listening to an audiobook, by the way, for the last, 7 years, every night. I go to sleep listening to some type of teaching, audiobook or something. In the last week, I've listened to your interviews, Brooks, which have been very interesting. And I think I'm learning from that, even though I fall asleep and have to restart the iPod at times and so forth. But this Kabbalistic thinking had to do with a case presented about giving. And it was about two people who routinely would give 10% of whatever they made to some charity or something. And the first case is of a man who just finished, a job as a drywall hanger and received $100. And as he left the place of employment, he walked down the street, and there was a beggar on the street. And he had his hat out, and he was unkempt, and he had a scowl on his face. And this man took out $10, gave it to the man, and the beggar looked at him and said, "Is that all?" And the man said, "Yes, that's all." And he walked on, and that was it. Never thought about it again. The second case is of a lady they present to say, "What about this type of giving?" It's a lady who had already given her 10% for that week or month or whatever. And she came across a woman and a child who were on the street, and they obviously were in bad shape. They needed clothes. They needed food. They were crying, and she stopped. She put her arm around them, reached into her pocketbook, and she gave them some money, and they hugged her, and they said what an angel she was, and they all felt warm. She went on her way, and everything was better. And the case I posed to people was like posed to me as I listened to this audiobook, which would be considered the highest form of giving with those two cases. So if you don't mind, Brooks, let me begin by asking you what your opinion would be on those two scenarios.
Well, giving is... you can, especially when you travel in third world countries, you can get numb to it because everyone is walking up to you with their hand down. And if you gave to everyone, you'd have nothing to, you know, buy souvenirs and take it home. Yeah. That isn't what it's about at all. I think my daughter probably had the best example of this. She was in Washington, D.C. with her high school class, and they were met with some street people. And they came up with a strategy that rather than just give them money, which they thought maybe they might, you know, go down to the local liquor store and, you know, pickle themselves again, they went in and they ate lunch and they got a to-go meal. Everything with it. Baked potatoes, steak, broccoli, the works. Bread and a drink. And they went outside and they gave the meal to the person on the sidewalk. And the way she relates the story to me is that the person opened the meal and began digging in and just could not comment enough about how beautiful the meal was and how wonderful it tasted. It was obvious she was hungry, probably hadn't eaten a meal like this in a month. And my daughter sat there and talked with her and listened to her while she ate her meal and drank her drink, and she said she felt so wonderful giving this meal to this woman. Now, it probably only helped her for, you know, one day. But it was the feeling that went with the giving. It was the gift that was exchanged both ways. The true charity, the true mercy of the soul, that is the spirit of giving. That is the value in giving. It's not the value of the PlayStation or the bicycle that you give to your kids at Christmas. It's the time. It's doing someone's hair. It's mowing their lawn next door without having to be asked. It's helping them in with their groceries just because you have a moment. That's the giving that the world really needs.
I understand that. You know, I received an email from a fellow named Robert who said he stops by to take his high school friend out of this place where he was recovering from a stroke. And he said the friend didn't have many visitors, but when Robert would go and he would take him in the wheelchair and he would bring him out and take him places, he said he saw a miracle happen, that the man started to walk without using that cane. And over the next few days, he was able to walk further and further. And he said it's been like a real miracle. And he said, "I think a lot of it had to do with listening to you on the radio." And I said, "No, Robert, no, no, no." I said, "It happened because you showed the love, and love is a powerful thing." And it was Dr. Bernie Siegel who first made that apparent to me, Brooks, in his book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, when I read that, I used to give that to every patient that came in with a malignant tumor. I would say, look, you need to start on now trying to figure out a way to overcome this. So this warm giving you mentioned in your daughter and that feeling is much like the lady may have experienced in that second case I put to you, right, where she had already done her giving, but she did a little more and everything. You remember that, right? But in the first case where the man, the beggar said, is that it? And kind of spit on the ground even. The man walked on and said, yes, that's it. Well, I put this question to many people, and especially on that TDB discussion group, because I wanted to relate that form of giving to two types of energy healing. One was Jurei, we've talked about, and the other is Reiki healing, which also claims to use a type of universal energy. The Kabbalistic answer to that problem, Brooks, was that the highest form of giving, even though both examples were great, the highest form was the first one, in which the man gave the $10, went on his way, and knew that whatever work was going to be done by that $10, it was going to go in the best possible way and the highest good of everyone, without his putting any type of attachment or modification on it. And this is what the Spindrift experiments have shown, and in the book by Bill Sweet, A Journey into Prayer, it shows that their research on things like yeast cells and with soybeans, that the best results were done when this prayer was given without any connection, modification, or intent. And to me, that was pretty significant as comparing energy healing. And it appears to me that it's a little better. You know, they're both good, Reiki and Jurei, but the Jurei a little bit better because you're letting that energy flow, and as the Spindrift research showed, it's a thy will be done, looking at this energy and letting it do the best possible thing.
Utterly fascinating. Well, that, you know, that is the whole art, well, I guess the esoteric part of being a physician, is you are a trained healer. In the more modern sense, in the sense that you apply the knife or the drug or whatever therapy there is, but there's also a dimension to healing that has to do with this unmodified flow of energy. And I guess one of the questions people ask, and they ask me from time to time when I'm out and about, where does the energy come from? Who's the supplier of the energy? How does it possibly work, and do I have to physically touch the person, or can I send healing to my mother in Canada and I live in Nebraska? Is that possible? Can we heal the distance?
Of course, even though Jurei, this has been done in the story of Okada's life in two books called The Light from the East, he mentions one time when he and his followers decided they would try to stop a fire across the river to some of their buildings by directing this Jurei energy that way. Reiki is more designed for touch healing or non-touch healing, and in particular long-distance healing. So people who have an interest in that type of healing, I would suggest Jurei. But the question I'd like to address, Brooks, is where does this energy come from? Now, that's the question. When we say universal energy, what are we talking about? And if you'd like to go on this vein, I think we can go. We may go a little deep in this, but can we go that direction?
Oh, you bet. We typically go well past the imagination of our listeners, but they know they're safe with us. Let's go.
I have a friend, and I have mentioned to you, named Ernie in Rhode Island, that we've been talking about this, what happened before the Big Bang. All right. Now, I had a chance to ask Dr. Alan Guth a direct question about dark energy and so forth, and if he felt it had something to do with this universal energy. And, of course, it's hard for anyone to give an answer on that nowadays. You know, people are talking about a fifth force that may have to do with some type of gravitational dark energy force. But if you look at it this way, and Mr. William Rand, who is like a Reiki expert, in one of his monthly journals, had an article about the Big Bang, and that if we're going to accept, if we can accept, those of us who believe there indeed was a Big Bang, and that Penzias and Wilson's cosmic background radiation kind of shows that, if we say that everything that we know, that means every particle, every energy, everything came as a result of the Big Bang, If we say that, that means that before the Big Bang, there was nothing. And this creation out of nothing, well, I've looked into that a lot and wondered about that. And recently I saw a video explanation of a collision of two parallel universes that caused this Big Bang. And it's all very deep, and why we can't go back now beyond that Planck time to examine what happened is utterly fascinating, and it's certainly way above my head. But if everything came from the Big Bang, I'd have to say that there was nothing, and it all came from nothing. But still, there is a force. There's a pervading force that we somehow can tap into by various methods. Now, I've always thought perhaps that force is that zero-point energy, and you've mentioned this in your talks about the Pauli exclusion principle and all these things showing that, you know, there is energy in every cubic space. And if we can imagine this perhaps going on to infinity, that column of space with that small energy in each cubic millimeter can add up to a considerable force, can it not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the fact that, you know, energy that's locally recreated, say in the death of a star through a supernova event where all the matter in that solar system's converted back to pure energy and then collapses back into matter again. All that matter, all that energy is entangled with one another. That is to say, there's a non-local communication between photons and protons and different subatomic particles, and this has been repeatedly proven in physics and in quantum mechanics. Not to throw out buzzwords, but the idea is that the spin, the energy state of particles can be affected by this energy that is commanded, if not channeled, by the human body.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, Brooks. You mentioned that 11-kilometer distance experiment that shows that. Right. I haven't read about that, but tell me, how was it ascertained that it was instantaneous? Because to know that, we have to kind of communicate with that 11-kilometer spot somehow.
They did it with atomic clocks. They had atomic clocks at both locations, so they change the spin at a precise nanosecond in the one location, and the exact same nanosecond linked to an atomic clock synchronized with the other one, the other particle changed spin. It was they expected some delay. In fact, they ran the clock, the two clocks, at such levels, and I think they were doing nanoseconds, they really expected to see at least a few nanoseconds being 11 kilometers apart, even at the speed of light, but it was absolutely instantaneous. The exact same nanosecond, the particle changed spin.
That's amazing. And you mentioned that, in your opinion, thought is faster than light, but this appears that maybe it's even faster than thought.
Well, it's hard to understand, hard to quantify, shall I say, because thought and this kind of experiment have not been scatterplotted against one another. That is to say, we haven't compared the speed of thought with the speed of energy entanglement, but that would be a most interesting experiment. It might cross the lines between quantum mechanics and metaphysics, but that's what we're all about. Let's give it a try. That's what I say.
No, I understand that. And if you'd like, I'd like to hear what you think about this parallel universe thing, because, for example, you know, my book starts out with a case of bleeding and surgery that I couldn't stop. You recall that, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, all right. Now, the question is, what really happened in that case? Was it a power of a prayer I uttered, or did I somehow insinuate myself into another type of a future, the one that I really wanted to be in? You know, I'm still thinking about how exactly did that work. Do you have any thoughts on that, Brooks?
Yeah, I do, and I really want to go into depth in that in the third hour, so I don't really want to get into it here in the second hour, because that's going to be the best discussion ever. I did have a question flashed in: what is the energy before the Big Bang? And, you know, that's the question every physicist is asking out there. That's why we built the super colliders. That's why CERN is out there and, you know, sparking all kinds of worries about generating a plethora of black holes and sucking us back through into another universe. But That's what we're trying to find out. What was the energy before the Big Bang? Because, you know, the smallest workable particle that we can get down to is a proton or a neutron or an electron, and we understand how those make atoms and dust molecules and so forth to all the physical matter that we see. And then we realize that well over 95% of our universe is dark energy and dark matter, and I personally believe that may be a little arrogant that we call it dark just because we can't see it. Maybe it's super bright energy and super bright matter, and it's beyond our ability or beyond wavelength to detect. In fact, it may be the subconscious of the universe. It's just it's hard to know because we don't have any instruments that can pick it up. There's no dark matter meter out there, and there's no dark energy meter out there, but we do see the perturbation of all this energy and all this matter jerking clusters and superclusters of galaxies around, just like our sun is the anchor around which all our planets revolve. So we see the effects of it, but we don't see it directly. We see it indirectly. So, you know, where does this energy begin? Where does it end? It's clear that there's at least another dimension, and maybe, most probably, at least mathematically speaking, parallel universes, and they're all happening at the same time. And so the question for the next hour is, and we want you to call in and contribute, our phone-in numbers are 530-776-5154 and 530-413-4511. If you've got a cell phone, if you're off-planet, on-planet, inside the planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at those numbers and ask a question, because we're going to be talking about parallel universes and actually moving in between them and carrying the rest of our lives along those paths. It's going to be interesting. My guest is Dr. John L. Turner, his book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. And we'll be back after this short musical break.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh you down with good intention.
Heaven.
Welcome back, my friends, to X Squared Radio, live from Western Idaho, where the wind is howling outside about 90 miles an hour, and the temperature is coming down, and I'm sure you're going to hear the train come by in just a moment. Anywhere where you build a biodiesel plant, you have to be close to the railroad, because that's how we ship stuff out, and that's how we get our raw materials in, so... If you hear the train come by, don't worry about it. It's not coming through the studio. It's outside, and we'll live through it. We do every morning when it comes by. The live H2O, United by Love, concert is coming up this summer. Put it on your calendar. June 19th through 21st, the banner is on the website. Sign up for it. It's not that expensive. 26 cities. Around the world, Los Angeles, Vancouver, all over the world. It is, for all intents and purposes, the greatest human experiment over more cities in history. All the music, all the musicians have retuned their instruments to the frequency of 528 hertz. It is the vibration of love, which can be transmitted harmoniously through water, the universal conductor of energy. We human beings are made mostly of water. If you're familiar with the work of Dr. Emoto, then you know the effect we can have on water. We're trying to reprogram the planet. Dr. Leonard Horowitz and his colleagues have determined scientifically that this can be done. Also, check out Our New Earth. OurNewEarth.tv, our friends we met down at the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference. They're doing great things in the world, lots of charity work around the world, and great documentaries out there. More stuff going up on their website all the time. Again, our call-in numbers, final hour of X Squared Radio. This is a three-hour program. If you're not getting all 3 hours, let us know. We'll take care of it with your affiliate. We're a member of the BBS Radio Network, the largest internet talk radio network on earth. Call in live, 530-776-5154 or 530-413-4511. And hang in there, because this is going to be an amazing hour. Dr. John L. Turner, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, A Doctor's Journey Through the Worlds of Divine Intervention, Near-Death Experiences, and Universal Energy. This hour, we're going to talk about parallel universes. Do we walk among them? Is the potential of all potentiality happening around us all the time? And are we moving between planes of existence? Let's talk about it. Are you there, Jack?
Yes, sir. I'm right here.
All right. We one of the interesting things that you see in the operating room that we don't get to see as people out in our jobs, our day jobs, is you put people under all the time. They're essentially relying upon an anesthesiologist to carry them through the procedures. And so while they're gone, they're having their experience, and you're having your experience in the operating room. But do we, because of our actions or inactions, float along, moving from universe to universe, where people live and people reach their full potential? Is that the question we're talking about this hour?
Yeah, that's the question. That's very well posed, and I can't say I have an answer, but I do have some thoughts on it.
Now, let's explore.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Well, just the last part of your book, you have some amazing sections here on the section called The Mind, and in the conclusion, and also now in Zen, which is kind of a play on words, but really cool ideas that there is, well, a path. And once you put your foot on the path, it's the same as completing the path. I thought that was completely fascinating, because we often ask people on this program, what's your dream? And I've had women say, well, I want to marry a rich man and have a big house. And I say, well, is that it? So what happens when that happens? Is your life over? Life is complete? You're ready to die? You know, it's about process. It's about stepping on the path. Isn't that the goal, after all? What is the path?
Well, that was my realization at the end of all this, and coming after the end of the book and near the end of my experiences, that all of those yearly things you mentioned that I tried, like Ekinkar and the Buddhist chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo and all these things, only to realize at the end of it that the path is everyday life. And this is the path. And as you mentioned, you're living in the now. That's the way we need to do. We need to try to be fully aware of every moment about these learning lessons that are coming at us left and right. And it was my wife, Sarah, who at the time I was married to her, told me that, Jack, life is a series of learning experiences. Once you've finished one and learned one, the next one is waiting. And as I mentioned earlier on the show, that at that time I was a resident in neurosurgery, and I can tell you that my feeling is about that job, it requires some type of an ego to get through it, because the tendency is always to quit and do something easier. Because in neurosurgery, you're almost always an intern until the last year when you're the chief resident. And it's a lot of work, and you have to really want to do it for some reason. And early on, when we're trying to learn the reason, we really don't know what we're doing, and it takes that ego to keep going. And the saying is, it takes years of training to learn how to, let's use the word cut, as far as a surgeon goes. And then it takes those years of practice. When you're finally in practice, you're in control to learn when to cut. But it takes your whole life to learn when not to, when the best thing to do is to not intercede and make things worse.
Wow.
So this idea of the right path, the parallel universes and all that is something I'd really like to discuss, because I have some thoughts. I may not have answers, but I certainly have thoughts in that regard.
Well, you asked the question in your book, do we live time after time in a continuously expanding and never-ending universe? Did you find the answer to that question?
You've looked at the book cover, right, with the dandelion in the pot?
Right, right.
And I had nothing at all to do with that cover except to approve it. This is one thing that the publisher, New Page Books, wanted to handle completely without my interference, so to speak. And I remember the day that this cover came up on the screen when they emailed me the photo saying, well, what do you think? This is what we want to go with. And as I sat there and looked at it, my wife, Mikie, who's from Tokyo, was with me looking. The first thing she said was, oh, this is a soft cover. It looks like it belongs on a coffee table. As I looked at it, I agreed, because the colors are in a subdued tones of brown and black and pink. And I said, yeah, that's true. And I saw this dandelion in a pot that had reached the clock phase. That's before it spreads out on the wind. I said, well, that's nice, because that's about what this is about. It's about repeated lifetimes, incarnations, trying to learn this thing that we kind of know is the state of unconditional love and true acceptance and understanding. And then I saw a teapot in the background, and I said, well, that fits with my last chapter now in Zen. This is all very Zen-like cover. But I missed the point, Brooks. I missed the point of this cover. There was more to it than that. And I received a call from my friend Clem in Ohio, who said, you know, doctor, I got to tell you again what I think about your cover. I told you I liked it, and I did. But as I looked at that again, the first thing I wondered is what kind of a person would put a dandelion in a flower pot and grow it. He said, over here we're trying to get rid of those things as weeds. He said, then when I saw the water pot, you know, behind it, I said, well, what kind of person would try to take good care of such a thing? What's the point in all this? He said, I'd have to pick up your book and look at it. But I think that was the point, that this is a never-ending story, and it's lessons just as that wife had told me, and once we learn one, the next one is waiting, and then I have concluded that we are in on the design of these lessons, and these are the things we want to go through, we want to learn. Therefore, if something comes along that we don't like or we think is hurtful or harmful or painful, we've got to realize there's a lesson here. Even though we may want to put a tag on this as being bad or rough, we've got to extract that lesson, get through it, and then get ready for the next one. So I agree, Brooks. I think this is a never-ending story, and it goes on, and it could possibly go on forever, except for one thing. Currently, the thinking is that everything in this particular universe is going to come to a frozen halt. Now, again, we're talking about eons and eons beyond our kin, but this will happen. And in this solar system, as I think you may have mentioned earlier, this sun will turn into the red dwarf. It will kind of zap everything out, maybe as far as the orbit of Jupiter. And then the white dwarf stage will come, and eventually everything in the universe may come to a very slow halt. I've always wondered, then what happens with all these spiritual things we were talking about? What do they go on in some other parallel universe, or how does that work? So, you know, I'd appreciate your comments on that too, Brooks. What do you think?
Well, the current cosmological view is eventually everything in the universe will become iron because the protons will continue to give up mass and they'll reach the lowest energy, most stable point on the chart of nuclides, and it'll just sit there and it'll get cold, as you said. But in doing so, it loses its expansive force and begins to contract. And contract it does all the way back to singularity, sort of like a breathing universe. That's the current cosmological view, one of them. And that the idea that each time the universe inhales and exhales, and all of these galaxies and all of this matter that we see and don't see goes from wave function to particle function back and forth, the oscillations become less and less. Or that when we inhale, that is to say, when the universe collapses back into singularity, it goes through a point and exhales into another universe. And that right now there's a collapsed universe on the other side of that portal that's just waiting to expand when ours collapses. So it's grand thinking, and it's very, you know, macrocosmic. We the interesting thing is that we're, even with our magnificent instruments that in the last 50 years, which is a cosmic microsecond, have put into space in our attempts to try to understand how the universe works, we still only look at the universe from our point of view, just like the religious leaders did of the Dark Ages. The solar system and the sun revolves around us and not the other way around, even though it was obvious to the pre-Egyptians, the Egyptians, and anyone with two pieces of polished glass that we, in fact, revolve around the sun. We still are looking at the universe from our point of view. And it is actually the human spirit, the human imagination, that allows us to picture the birth of universes, not our instruments. And it's interesting because in the chapter that I just quoted, that sentence, in the very next sentence you say, do we have free will, or are we pre-programmed and guided every step of the way? And I think by now, and you had some interesting statistics in your book too, which is the less educated, that is to say those that achieved less than high school or high school educations, something like 90% of them believe in God. Maybe it's even higher than that. But the more educated, specifically physicists, less and less of them, somewhere around 45% of them, believe in God. And so it looked like there was, at least according to the way the data was collected, the belief in God was inversely proportional with the amount of education that you have. But I take issue with that, because I think it is the definition of God that changes, not the belief in God that changes. That maybe the educated do not believe that there's some all-powerful being sitting on a throne somewhere in the universe, tapping heads saying, you go to hell, you go to heaven, you go to hell, you go to heaven. Maybe with more education we see the beauty and the poetry and the math and balance of the universe, and we admit that there is a creator, but that he is us. We are him.
Well, how about this, Brooks? You mentioned that chapter, Now in Zen, and so forth. I start that chapter by a quote from Dr. Wayne Dyer. And perhaps this is what you mean by the more educated, there are changing concepts in what we call this. That quote is simple. It says, a few minutes a day in total awe will contribute to your spiritual awakening faster than any metaphysics course. That's the realization that there is something quite powerful. We don't know what to call it. It may not be the traditional God with a flowing robe and a white beard and all that. But there's some type of force that we're aware of regardless of our education. And as Greg Braden put it in his book or audiobook Beyond Zero Point, he said, and I quote, is there a single creative source of all that we will ever witness in our lives, in our world? Is it possible that every life event, without exception, is part of that force? And I think that's the question you're raising. What is going on? What is this force, and what does it mean? But also, the recent studies show that 70% of Americans believe in the devil. Now, is that another force or something we should even be considering, or what? So I'm not sure what education does other than what you say. It changes our description of this powerful force of the creator, or whatever you want to call it. And at this point in my life, I've chosen to call it the creator, acknowledging that it is there, and it's something that has to do with that spark of life and has to do with everything we see around us. That's the way I'm looking at it now, sir.
Well, I'm right with you on this. You know, the awakening to which this awe contributes is a realization that there's really two things going on here. There's the physical body. There's the peas and carrots that we sow in the ground and the wind that we feel upon our face. But there's also the animated energy of it, the energy of the planet, the energy of the birth of a child, of the soul that is inside of us and stares back at us in the mirror in the morning. There is that universe that we know exists, and yet we can't put our hands on it. It makes the universe move, and it makes it alive. It's life itself. It's not cold, dark, unimaginative iron floating lifelessly in the darkness of space. It is the imagination, the spirit, the love, the union, the learning. And then, you know, when you think about that 79% of the people believe in the devil, It brings to mind the realization that many people reach their front porch, whether it's an apartment or a house, and realize they don't have what it is they dreamed of having when they got here. And it must be the fault of the devil. There is someone to blame it on. There's someone to foist the darkness upon, even though previously his name was Lightbringer. Right now we have a caller on line 3. What is your first name and where are you calling from, please?
Hello?
Yes, well, you're there. Welcome to the program.
Oh, yes. My name is Daniel. I'm calling from Minnesota.
Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank you personally for your talk at the Round the School of Enlightenment a while back. And I was just listening to your program this evening, and I'd like to ask the doctor, is his healing modality, is that in line with the Sukumakari?
Can you repeat that, sir? I'm not familiar with that term, with the super what? I couldn't hear that very well.
I was going to ask you, is your healing, does that have to do with the Sukumakari, like the centers they have in North America
here? No, I know what you're talking about now. No, it's not. This is called Jorei, the medical art of Japan, and Mr. Okada, before he died in 1955, he predicted that at the turn of the century, East would meet West as far as the holistic care of the patient. And he said it will have to start in Hawaii. He had never been to Hawaii, but he felt that this was the place for East and West to join. There are centers in Los Angeles, and there are other centers that are a little bit different than the group I work with, but also teach Okada's philosophy. And you can find that on the Internet. Just do a search for Mokichi Okada or for Jorei, J-O-H-R-E-I. And there are many places where people can get involved in this. They can obtain the Ohikari by showing that they have some knowledge of Okada's philosophy. Once they can demonstrate that they understand how this works, they can try it and see for themselves, does this work? So that Mahikari you're talking about, no, that's something different and something I don't know a lot about, but as you were talking, I started to remember a little bit about that. This is quite different. The word Hikari in Japanese means light. By putting a O in front of it, it's the honorific form saying that this is something very special when we talk about an Ohikari. That's the amulet these people wear that connects them with Okada, with what is called a spiritual cord. In Hawaii, we call them aka cords, strongest between families. But nevertheless, some type of spiritual cord that acts on a dimension of which we know very little about. I hope that helped answer your question, Daniel.
Yes, that was good. I got a friend who's in the Super Monokari, and they got a autotomen or whatever that they wear, and then they can actually emit the energy through their palm and their hand. And it's very effective in a lot of cases. And one question, one thing on the parallel universes. I study at the Ralph School of Enlightenment, and truthfully, I don't think there's a better place on the planet where one can get enlightened on the subject you're talking about, because the master teacher there has talked about parallel universes for many years, and basically what we learned there is that all of us are actually seven energy beings. We have seven levels of consciousness and energy, and of course we can facilitate healing on different levels depending on our level of, how evolved we are. And basically it comes down to affecting the quantum field, because we're all a grid in the electromagnetic field, and if one can focus and put his intent in that direction, well, just with a thought you can heal at any distance. But anyway,
well, Daniel, what you're saying is interesting, but unfortunately with the hookup I can barely hear you. Could you make that out, Brooks, and maybe reiterate for Daniel?
I got a little bit of it. It was a little echoey, and I apologize for that. But the Ramtha School of Enlightenment is a school in Yelm, Washington, where they learn basically to focus energy, not only to project, but also to receive information. And they actually use the hands as sort of a parabolic antenna in a blindfolded exercise to find an icon or a little picture that they have put on a rail. And this is not a small area, Jack. This place is about twice the size of a football field, and they're walking around it completely blindfolded, trying to find an image that's face down on a fence rail around this. And hundreds of people do this. They find that image just by focusing on that image, and they learn a technique of breathing and concentrating and what they call walking in a new neighborhood, where they really get in touch with this etheric world where energy actually communicates. And it is absolutely fascinating to watch and to participate in, I've got to say.
I've never heard of that. That is interesting. Well, thank you for sharing that, Daniel.
Yeah, that's quite all right. But I would say, if there's anybody that has an interest, I don't think there's any place in the world you can find this information, and one would have to check it out for themselves. But there's many of books that has been published by Ramtha and many talks. And as far as I'm concerned, if a person's looking for the unknown, that's the place to find it. And I'll let you gentlemen go, and I appreciate your time.
Well,
thanks, Daniel, and thanked Ramtha School of Enlightenment for amazing energy. I mean, good night. About 1,400 people in standing ovation, just unbelievable enlightened people. Every single one a sovereign being. I really, really enjoyed speaking up there. It was a good experience. So let's talk again. We have about 35-40 minutes left in the hour, and I want to because we're both exploring the same thing. You have excellent professional training and experience, and very close interaction, saving lives and involved in improving the quality of life for people, and understand not just the duty but also the love of giving. And I think that this is tied into this idea of parallel universes, that we somehow tap into the potential of all potentialities that around us and under us and through us are the consequences of every single one of all of the choices of every sentient being in the universe. And how we move through that with this physical body is completely up to us. Do you agree?
I think that it's up to us only insofar as we can hit this 200 millisecond window in which we can make a change. And this is a point that's really worthy of discussion, this free will versus what you might call free want. And there was something discovered that research is ongoing now called the Bereitschaft potential. In German, that would mean readiness potential. And this was discovered some time ago. There's a great book about it called the Bereitschaft potential. It's a negative cortical, meaning the cortex of the brain, electrical potential, which begins about a second or so prior to the onset of a motor movement. Now, the doctor I refer to his studies in my book, named Benjamin LeVay, found that this started about a third of a second before subjects actually were aware of a conscious movement. Now, it's true, they're talking about motor movements. They're not talking about decisions about what to do with the family problem this or how to sell your house or whatever, complex thinking. But it shows that we seem to lag behind our motor movements by about a third of a second, as if we do not have free will. And a lot of studies now have shown that, now with functional MRI and so forth, we can see now that what Dr. LeVay was picking up on electroencephalographic electrodes and recordings can now be seen as active hotspots in the brain, and that, yes, before we have the conscious awareness of an act, the circuits are already firing. Now, these are circuits that it's felt to be initiated in the subconscious mind that start to work. And in fact, in April, I think, a year ago, it was shown that maybe you could pick up this kind of potential seconds ahead of this event. So are we really following a pre-programmed path, as I seem to suggest in my book, by saying we write this out in the spiritual world, we work on what we want to do this next go-around, and boom, the slate is wiped clean, except perhaps those prodigies you mentioned who may somehow have some of Beethoven's skill coming out in that piano playing from some previous life. But for most of us, we're going on our path of trying to reach that goal of, which I think is unconditional love. And as we go through these lifetimes, we're following that plan. But Dr. LeVay's work did allow a 200 millisecond period, a fifth of a second, in which if we're focused and really in the now and we see what's happening, we may be able to change what's already in progress. So I think it is a result of several things, what already is planned for us that we wanted to go through, but also when we need to modify it from time to time, can we if we're sharp? And I think we've got to stay sharp. We've got to realize that although that 2 ounces of alcohol recommended for a man, 1 ounce for a woman for cardiac protection is okay, it may dull our reaction time and our senses just enough that we miss that opportunity when we should be right on top of the problem. So I do agree with you, and then in a way I have to disagree, saying that for the most part it appears that it's going to head one direction unless we're on top of it. That's what I think.
Well, I see that. And 200 milliseconds, in my opinion, is plenty of time to get ready. And I don't know if the whole thing's scripted before we get here or if we're feverishly writing as we're going through our mortal life. Okay, I'm going to change this part and alter that.
Well, there you go with the parallel universe thing, because that could be what happens. And as I said, when I thought the prayer stopped the bleeding, maybe it wasn't that at all. Maybe, you know, that one future out of an infinite number is the one I wanted to be on, and I was able to kind of slip into it, leaving everything else unchanged, but that one event. That's
absolutely
possible.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that coalescing, because that's what I feel it is. We have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Mark from Albuquerque.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Brooks. Another fine, fine program. Good evening, Dr. Turner.
Well, hello, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I wanted to thank you, Dr. Turner, for all that you've done for each patient that you've worked with. And thank you for becoming a master healer.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. That's very flattering, but I've tried to do my best.
Yeah, well, you're not a practicing surgeon anymore. You're a master healer. There's a little bit of difference. You're not practicing anymore. But anyway, I was very interested in what you're talking about. And one of the things that came across to me while you were speaking, you were talking about so-called dark matter, dark energy. And what was the percentage, Brooke, you gave for the amount of it being in the universe?
The combination of the two is somewhere between 94 and 96%. There are some arguments out there and more discoveries being made, but it's way up there.
Right. Well, that's pretty close to omnipresent, isn't it? I mean, it's not 100% omnipresent, obviously, but that's one thing that I was getting from the conversation is if you allow it, it could well be consciousness. That energy, that matter, is actually consciousness.
It is
what is directing what we do. That's why when we think or when we have our intent and then it occurs, especially when we're helping others, we're just tapping into that which is all around, which is that energy.
Well,
you know,
I think
Mark,
Ed Dames would agree with that, that there's some Akashic record out there that you tap into somehow. And he has a drawing and a binary technique that you go through that that Dr. Turner also studied. Can you talk about that, Jack?
Well, I would say yes. Ed Dames would call it the Matrix. Courtney Brown had another term for it. Other people call it the Akashic Records. And actually, it seems like it's the collective unconscious that Carl Jung talked about long ago, and that everything, about everything, is out there someplace on some dimension. And the trick is, can we send our mind out to do it? I'd be happy to talk about remote viewing and what it means, but first I'd like to address something Mark has brought up that's very interesting.
Sure.
And to me, this consciousness and so forth may have to do with the quantum mechanics of it, as in the Schrödinger cat experiment. Could I talk about this briefly?
Yeah, Schrödinger's cat. That's a classic.
Yeah, well, basically, Mark, if you're not familiar, and people who are listening, that's the thought experiment that says basically if you have a cat inside the box, and Schrödinger, by the way, wrote the wave equation when he was in his mid-20s, and we tend to peak in our cognitive abilities, our thinking abilities, when we're 22, and by age 27, that's the onset of old age, actually. So these people have done brilliant stuff in their early 20s, and Schrödinger was one who came out with that wave equation. And basically, particles and waves, well, let's say we have a cat in the box, and there's a radioactive element that emits the alpha particle, let's say, and that when that happens, a mechanical device will break a beaker and it will release some noxious gas and the cat will die. And the question is, before you open the box and you're asked, well, what is the state of this cat? Is it alive or dead? It turns out that it's a superposition of states of alive and dead. And the determination is only made when we interact. We open the box and then it's said that the wave function of that cat collapses. Okay? And this may be the way consciousness works. We only need it when we need it. And Brooks, I think in one of your interviews you mentioned something about a brick wall. And is it really there if you're not paying attention to it or have no need to look at it or whatever? Do you remember that, Brooks?
Oh, yeah. It was an argument just like this. Planck and Einstein and others were in, and Einstein said, the moon does not exist because a mouse looked at it.
Well, and also, who said I refuted thus and hurt their toe kicking the rock? Remember that? So here's the thing. There, is a movie or an episode of Twilight Zone or Outer Limits, and which a friend, Rick, told me about, and we can't find this movie, and Mark, maybe you or a listener knows, but it's about a man who finds out that when he turns a corner, there is a group of construction workers that has already completed making that street for him. They've made every detail down to the last insect on a blade of grass, every building, every car is all waiting for him when he turns the corner. And then when he gets to the next corner, he turns to find the same thing has happened. This whole set has been constructed. And since time and space seems to be different for these construction people, they may have had what we consider to be years to complete this construction, but when the man needs it, there it is. So I'm wondering, Mark, are you alluding to something like this in our consciousness, that we kind of form our own reality by when we need to interact with something, then it appears for us? But otherwise, it may not be real.
Something along those lines, except for we have the collective agreement to what the reality is that we're experiencing on many levels. In order to experience this third dimensional reality, there has to be some cohesion of intent. So that's why if you go out to start the car, it starts, and it's a car there, and because we have collectively said this is what it is. But what I was getting at was what would give us that energy, that power, could well be what we call the dark energy or dark matter, being that is the universal consciousness. It is what many would call God. It is what we tap into. Because we're a part of it, we don't tap into it, we just utilize it because we're a part of it, just as the earth is, just as everything else is. Which comes back to the all is one, because we're all particles and all that stuff. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yes, I follow you. I understand what you're saying, and I just don't know how to comment because I wish I knew the answer to all that, but that was...
Right, it was just a hypothesis because it just came, it kind of, you know, it intuited in, I do that. In fact, right before you said something about the full moon having more patients and more traumatic injuries, I was thinking I should call and ask him if he has experienced the full moon thing. It was like 20 seconds before you said it. I can't prove it, but that's it. Kind of came to me when you were speaking of it. And said, well, this is everywhere. We can't measure it, but. And we don't know if it has an effect, but very possibly the effect it has is just as I postulate that it could be through us and our thoughts and our intent that
here's
we use
think,
this
Mark.
Energy.
Yeah, I think this is... Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say this is kind of the question I posed to Dr. Guth after a lecture here. I was fortunate to meet him in Hilo. And Dr. Guth, by the way, has a theory of the accelerating universe, so kind of MIT type of genius guy, and I'm just glad he took a question from me. But I asked him about dark energy, which in some form we think, not we, but they think, the people who know of negative gravity that seems to pull our universe apart. And the percentage of all that we know, maybe, what is it, 70-something, 73%, and dark matter, another 23%, and what we know as ordinary matter would... is 4%, and of that, these stars and everything we see is only about half a percent or so. But again, of course, it was hard for him to answer that in the setting, and I don't know if there is an answer to it, Mark, but it's something that I think we're going to find out more about as consciousness proceeds and as we try to answer these questions. And as Brooke said, we come to answer the call and find out what is going on and how do we best get through this and what it's all about.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and once again, I thank you for all you've done, and Brooks, thank you for another great show, and whenever you get to Albuquerque, I'll see you again.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark.
All right, have a great night.
All right. You know, it could be that the dark energy and dark matter is the construction materials that make the street scene that you talked about in the Twilight Zone episode. Maybe... that is the wave function that's just beyond our comprehension that's collapsing into the visible matter that we see in our universe. And maybe the universe is just waiting for the last few percent of stars and planets and whatever to pass over to that side. It's hard to tell. We're kind of in between phases, and no one's lived long enough or been cognizant of it long enough to have a line to extrapolate toward the answer.
Well, look, Brooks, you're kind of familiar now with my friend Martin, who was the webmaster for my website, right?
Right.
And how, after his passing, well, before his passing, he was interested in doing research with me on EVP and ITC, electronic voice phenomena and so forth. And through the Australia-Asian EVP Society, I met people who were able to kind of give me some tips in this regard. And after his death, actually a day before his death, I asked him, was he still interested in pursuing this research? And he said, absolutely. And after returning from London, some incredible things have happened that all seem to tie in with this. And I remember Martin specifically telling me during one of his visits to Hilo, as we stood outside my house and we looked up in the night sky and we saw the constellation Orion clearly, and he said, Jack, did you ever wonder if the reason we can see these stars? He said, you know, we can't right now physically find out how to ever get there. But just the fact that we can see them and appreciate them, do you think they're there to facilitate communication? And I had never thought anything about that. And now as I put all these pieces together, and as I think back to London when I put that pattern Orion on the bulletin board at the foot of his bed on the wall so he could see it, and then some dreams that then followed that had to do with Orion, and all these theories now about the plateaus in Arizona, and the villages outlined by some Indians in the pattern of Orion, and then in Giza, the three pyramids for the Orion's belt location. It's all very strange, and Martin may be right. Those stars are there for some other reason, too, not just that 0.4% of ordinary matter. Maybe there is a way they facilitate communication. Have you thought about that, Brooks?
Well, not from exactly that standpoint, but certainly when one looks at, say, the Great Pyramid and the star shafts that were carefully constructed in them, it does seem strange that they point toward the star Sirius now, and they pointed toward the star Sirius when it was constructed. It kind of means that Sirius hasn't moved relative to the Earth. All the other stars have. We've kind of moved through precession, and the polar star for us changes from age to age as we're beginning the age of Aquarius here shortly. But Sirius has stayed in the same place. And
one has to ask the question, why? Well, am I correct in remembering that the pharaohs felt that their soul would join the stars of Orion's belt, and therefore those chambers from the Queens and King's Chamber that seemed to be focused on these areas, that was the reason. And also, what about this, Brooks? What about the Dogons of Mali, knowing that there was a double star system way before any type of missionaries appeared to try to teach them? They had no telescopes, but yet if you look at their huts at Mali, they look like kind of cone-shaped spaceships, and they kind of knew about this system. So that dog star can be very important as it follows Orion as it sets and rises. Very interesting, isn't it?
No question about it. No question about it. And by the way, Earth is the sixth planet by their recollection, because they count the planets from the outside in, not from the inside out. And we didn't even discover Pluto till a long time later.
Yeah, they better read Dr. Tyson's book about Pluto, then they may have to revise their counting.
Yeah, I understand Pluto has now been rejected as a planet because it's hollow. Interesting. So let me get back to this, because we got a few minutes left. We were talking about awareness of conscious movement, and I wanted to make sure I understood this, that we have a third of a second before we're aware of conscious movement. Are you saying that the pitcher releases the ball toward the batter, and the batter has approximately a third of a second before he can make a conscious movement, or he has a third of a second after he's made the conscious movement that he's aware he's swinging the bat?
Let's say the pitcher is going to throw a curveball. Before he positions his fingers on the seams of that ball to throw a curve, the areas of the brain that are going to position that finger start to fire a third of a second before he says, okay, I'm going to do a curveball.
Wow.
He's lagging behind what's going on by about a third of a second. And you know, I'm really extrapolating here because it's probably a lot more complicated than this, but that was it. For motor actions, these potentials, the readiness potential, is picked up ahead of the conscious awareness of an act about to happen. So I hope that clarifies that. That's what I meant. Now, as far as the batter getting ready to swing, as that ball is headed his way, if we could slow it down in time a third of a second before he starts to swing, he's already, muscles are starting to get ready to make that move before he's aware of it. That's what I was trying to say, the results of LeBay's work showed.
So maybe there is a spirit version of the batter and the pitcher that is making, as you say, the spiritual creation or the spiritual intention to move even before the neurosystems can send the signals to begin to move.
If that spirit is in the subconscious mind, then I would agree. That seems to be the way it works. And, of course, I'm a tyro in this field. I know very little about the subconscious mind or even the conscious mind, but it appears to me that's the way it works. There's some motivating force, and it could be that this is the plan that was constructed for us before our incarnation here, that this is what we're following, just like we're following a script. So we do have some element of free will if we need to make a modification from time to time, but we've got to be on the ball.
Interesting. In baseball, we call that a balk, by the way, changing our mind and backing up. So maybe let's relate this to astral mechanics then. If we're trying to disconnect the spirit or subconscious, or for that matter, the conscious part of the being from the physical part of the being, so we get an outside looking in kind of perspective, or the ability to move through space and time, not only to observe, but also to affect those places and times that we visit. This may be the key. This few microseconds, or now we have thousands of microseconds in a third of a second, to make these excursions, if we could only be aware of them.
I'll say this much for that. I had mentioned a couple times my friend Ernie, and the reason I mention him, he's a fellow I've only met on the internet, much the way I met good people like Martin and now like you, for example, and have formed lasting friendships. So we've discussed this matter of consciousness, free will, the Big Bang, and all that, all these types of things. The question is, how does it all work and why? There was one time, and this is a good story, I sent this man Ernie an email with a GIF of a giraffe chewing, a close-up on a giraffe's head and neck chewing something. And I said in the email, Ernie, why don't you chew on this? I think it's time for you to watch the movie A Waking Life. And at that same day, close proximity when he read the email, his uncle Ed sent him that movie in the mail. So he's trying to say, what is the coincidence here? What does it mean? And he started watching it, and now he got me to go back and watch it again. And he asked me to watch the last part. He said, Jack, I want you to watch that pinball player and tell me what you think. Well, what that is, it's the man who the character meets in the first part of the movie and then at the end. He says, what we know as life may be just a moment. And, you know, I had to think about that a lot, because everything that we've gone through, everything we know, Brooks, and this may all be just a moment, just a long, drawn-out dream, which really is lasting as far as the time that we don't know about, that we should be aware of, only a moment, only an instant. But to us, it seems long and drawn out. Robert Moss, in his book, Dreamtime of the Rackies, in an interview on Dreamland with Ann Strever, said, he was had a dream in which it lasted 90 years or something like that, in which he was a shaman and so forth, but to him, it was a 90-year period, that particular dream. So who knows how this works? I wish I knew, and I don't. And maybe to try to figure it out is something beyond the ability of our brains, Brooks. Maybe one way to look at this, and most people might agree, to say, like the Zen Buddhists say, in one word, thus. Everything is the way it is because that's just the way it is. And no matter how hard we try to figure it out, it may be a good exercise, but it may be futile. Maybe our best way is to just say, thus.
Well, it may be futile, but we we still want to feel as though we're in command. We still want to feel as though we're sovereign. And so when we focus on the absolute now, that the actual putty that we have in our hands now, then we can shape that exact moment. And we have, and maybe it's a sub-moment of the moment of life. One of my favorite episodes of Star Trek Next Gen is when Jean-Luc is taken, sort of, by a probe and is allowed to live an entire lifetime down on a planet, have a family and grow old and have friends and see friends die and all that, just to help that society develop its first rocket so that it could discover space. And in the end, the probe releases him, but he keeps that life experience, that whole 80 or 90 years of life that he had in 15 minutes that this probe held him in this sort of memory journey. It's, I think, my most poignant memory of Star Trek Next Generation. But the point that I wanted to make was, in the now, we can focus consciously as opposed to the vast majority of people we see going through life unconsciously. And we can actually change things. We can actually make our minds up whether we're going to react with anger or whether we're going to react with love, whether we're going to be acted upon by the universe, thus, or whether we are going to act upon the universe. And that, I think, is the difference between the positive and the negative. We're moved between universes by happenstance and destiny, or we move between universes as a sovereign being empowered with wings to be able to choose as we go?
That's a great question. And I might try to address that by saying there's another episode of Next Generation you would love, where this Jean-Luc is in three different time periods, going between them at the same time, trying to figure it all out. That was a great episode, too. I can't recall the exact name, but it's on the time travel series of that.
That was the feature film. That's when the, Kirk, all of them were together in the same episode.
This is different. This is different. This is just Jean-Luc in an episode where he's a very old man working on his winery, but he has these flashbacks from other periods of time. That one I'm talking about. But now, I'd like to say this about the parallel universe thing. When Fred Allen Wolf first came out with that book, The Theory of Parallel Universes, I loved it. I bought it for people as a gift because I said, now here's something that'll wake you up. And basically the thought is that whenever we're confronted with a decision, it's true that there are an infinite number of ways it could go, right? For example, you could interrupt me now and say, Dr. Turner, it's been great having you on and blah, blah, blah. Or you could listen to what I'm going to say, which I hope you do. But an infinite number of things. But when I make the choice, like right now, to continue finishing my statement, all those other possibilities exist. So there is that world where you said, well, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we got to go now, commercial time. And there's all the other ones that could have happened that actually do happen. So that's the question. Are we really kind of always going between these? And when we wake up in the morning, is it because we're waking up into a new universe or what? It's mind-boggling to think of it, but when you think of the power of the brain, the powers in this universe, it's not too big of a job to do this.
Yeah, the real question is, where do we go? Do we sleep?
Well, as some have mentioned, perhaps this is the dream. And as George Norrie mentioned in a conversation with a lady, expert on dreams and EVP, recording, as she said, I think this is what happens. And George said, well, perhaps this is the dream. What we think is real life is the dream, and maybe people exit our dream through dying. And that was a good thought. I'm still thinking on that one.
Yeah, it's interesting to think, are we opening our eyes, or are our eyes closed right now? That's one to meditate on, to be sure. I kind of get a reality check when I have a pain, though. Then I realize, oh yeah, that part's real right there. I hit my little finger one time with a hammer about 15 years ago, and although I can't really recall the pain right at this moment, I mean I can't bring it back as a memory, I will always remember hitting that little finger with that hammer. Man, it hurt so bad I thought I was going to die. It was my little finger, for crying out loud.
Yeah, that's why I met Brooks. You were refuting it thusly.
Yes, I was. Even though I was on top of a wall and couldn't climb down until I finished driving that nail. Boy, did that hurt. That lets you know it's real.
Yes, I understand.
Well, marvelous, marvelous interview. I highly recommend this book, and it'll be up on our website until the earth cools. Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, A Doctor's Journey Through the Worlds of Divine Intervention, Near-Death Experiences, and Universal Energy. And there's a lot more in this book than that, as you can tell from this interview. We will post this interview on the archives tonight. Those of you that didn't get it live, if you're listening tomorrow, make sure to make contact with Dr. Turner. Let him know that you heard his program here on X Squared Radio and that you've bought his book. And believe me, he's affecting the universe with this book because it's a real eye-opener. And I, for one, really appreciate you coming on the program tonight.
Thank you, sir. It's been my pleasure, and I hope to see you when you come to Hawaii.
You know, I'm going to try to do that. I went there a couple of years ago for an Earth Transformation Conference with Michael Sala, and amazing. I mean, just like, it's like going to heaven. It's like going to the Garden of Eden. The ocean is so clean and beautiful, and the weather is so amazing. And as you mentioned in your book in the beginning, the people are so spiritually awake, and I don't mean religious. I mean they're spiritually awake. They accept you, and they smile at you with intention, and you feel love vibrating from those islands. It's really an amazing place.
That's nice to say, and as you know, aloha means hello and also means goodbye. So I will say aloha to you, sir, and I appreciate the chance to having talked with someone of your caliber and knowledge in physics, and I'm sorry we couldn't go a little deeper into things because I can learn a lot from you.
Well, we'll talk again then. We'll keep trading emails because there's a lot I can learn from you as well. Thank you so much for coming on the program, and aloha to you.
Aloha.
Well, there you have it, my friends, Dr. John L. Turner. Another 3 hours gone in 15 minutes here on X Squared Radio. Don't forget, if you're just now tuning in, this is a three-hour program, and there are two other hours that you can enjoy. We break them up into one-hour segments in the archives. Sign up. It's about $20 a year, $2.50 a month if you just want to listen for a month, but there's well over 200 hours of interviews just like this one. And don't forget to mark your calendar, Live H2O. It is a global concert, 26 cities, and world-class musicians retuning their instruments to 528 hertz, the vibration of love. It is an experiment to reprogram the water of Earth to try to heal the planet. The link is at the website, xsquaredradio.com. We'll see you next week right here. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.